Chapter 7. The Egyptian Empire. Of the chronology of all these ancient nations, that of early Egypt is the most uncertain. With respect to the chronology of the earlier times of both Babylon and Assyria, there is indeed a considerable element of uncertainty. Yet there it is possible to know, in most instances, that we are somewhere near the correct time, especially in the case of Assyria. But with early Egypt the uncertainty is absolute. More testimony from Egyptian monuments has been found and read than from any other nation. But the difficulty of this subject had increased with the new information of the monuments. The statements of ancient writers were easily reconciled with half-knowledge. But better information shows discrepancies which are in most instances beyond all present hope of solution. It may be said that we know something of the outlines of the technical part of Egyptian chronology. But its historical part is in a great measure mere conjecture, before the times when we can check the Egyptian list by their synchronisms with Hebrew and Assyrian history. The greatest of all the obstacles in the way of establishing a regular Egyptian chronology is the fact that the Egyptians themselves never had any chronology at all. The use of a fixed era was unknown, and it has not yet been proved that they had any other reckoning than the years of the reigning monarch. Now these years themselves had no fixed starting point. For sometimes they began from the commencement of the year in which the preceding king died, and sometimes from the day of the coronation of the king. A monarch might occupy the throne 10 years in conjunction with his father, 32 years alone, and 3 years in conjunction with his son. In an Egyptian royal list he will be credited with 45 years, although his first 10 years will be assigned also to his father, and his last 3 years to his son. Contemporary dynasties, if accepted as legitimate, will appear in an Egyptian list as consecutive. While dynasties not so accepted, however long they may have reigned, will disappear altogether. No less than 10 distinct schemes of Egyptian chronology have been attempted by the Egyptologists of the present age. And these adorn critics of the best judgment and the widest knowledge, basing their conclusions on identically the same data, have published to the world views upon the subject which are not only divergent and conflicting, but which differ, in the estimates that are the most extreme, to the extent of above 3,000 years. BOCKH gives for the year of the accession of Menes M.A., the supposed first Egyptian king, the year B.C. 5702. Unger, the year B.C. 5613. Mariette Bey and Lenormand, B.C. 5004. Bruges Bey, B.C. 4455. Loth, B.C. 4157. Lepsius, B.C. 3852. Bunsen, 3623 or 3059. Mr. Reginald Stuart Poole, B.C. 2717. And Sir Gardiner Wilkinson, B.C. 2691. It is as if the best authorities on Roman history were to tell us, some of them that the Republic was founded in B.C. 508, and others in B.C. 3508. Such extraordinary divergency argues something unique in the conditions of the problem to be solved. And it is the more remarkable, since the materials for the history are abundant, and include sources of the most impeachable character. Until some fresh light shall be thrown upon this point by the progress of discovery, the uncertainty attaching to the Egyptian chronology must continue, and for the early period must be an uncertainty, not of centuries, but of millennia. The sum of the matter seems certainly to be, and he can never be too often repeated, that the Egyptians themselves had no chronology. It never occurred to them to consider, or to ask, how long a dynasty had occupied the throne. They had no era. They drew out no chronological schemes. They cared for nothing but to know how long each incarnate god, human or bovine, had condescended to tarry upon the earth. They recorded carefully the length of the life of each Apis bull, and the length of the reign of each king. But they neglected to take note of the intervals between one Apis bull and another, and omitted to distinguish the sole reign of a monarch from his joint reign with others. With respect therefore to calculations based upon ancient Egyptian chronology, the conclusion seems to be that, however precise these calculations may appear to be, modern science must always fail in its attempts to restore what the Egyptians never possessed. The Egyptians themselves held that the gods were their first rulers, and after these the demigods. This made it perfectly easy for them to give to themselves as many dynasties, and as many thousands of years to each dynasty, as they might choose to imagine. And the modern scientists, holding as tenaciously to the theory of evolution as the Egyptians did to their gods, can by the evolutionary hypothesis just as easily support all that the Egyptians propose by their theory of the gods. The evolutionist holds that man is a product of development from protoplasm through the ape and the missing link. He sees that in early Egypt, civilization and art had attained to a high degree of development. He finds no evidence that there were any people in Egypt before the Egyptians, who have always been there. He knows, as everybody must know, that it would take no little length of time for a protoplasmic chit to evolve itself unto the kind of man that could build the pyramids, set up the Sphinx, and construct the wonderful Hall of Columns. Therefore, putting all these things together, he knows well enough that Egyptian history s cover numerable ages. But to the person who is acquainted with creation and revelation, to the person who knows the power and faithfulness of the Word of God, there is no such fallacious necessity. Such ones know that mankind has generated from perfection to the condition in which he was in ancient Egypt, and in Greece and Rome when Christ came into the world. And knowing this, it is perfectly easy to understand the condition of ancient Egypt, or any other ancient nation, without resorting to myths and fables. It may properly be inquired, also, if development instead of degeneracy be the universal law, why is it that Egypt and every other ancient nation has degenerated? If development instead of degeneracy is the law, why is it that the ancient Egyptians were adepts in arts and appliances which are utterly beyond the ken, and only excite the wonder, of even the 19th century development? Why also is it that in philosophy, art, and law the people of this 19th century are obliged to be mere copyists of the ancient Greeks and Romans? It is true that the 19th century after Christ knows many things that the 19th century before Christ did not know. So also the 19th century before Christ knew much that the 19th century after Christ does not know. But if development be the universal and prevailing law, why were not all these ancient things retained and improved upon by mankind through all the centuries following? There is one point, however, upon which the ancient Egyptian theory of the rule of the gods has the advantage of the modern theory of evolution and has at least the reflection of a truth. It clearly points to a time when the Egyptians knew God and served him only, and had no king or ruler other than God. Then when a king did set himself, or was set, as ruler over them, he put himself in the place of God, and claimed to be, not merely the representative of God, but the very impersonation of God. He claimed identity with God, and was addressed as a god. Such was the theory of the Egyptian kingship. And it plainly shows a departure from the original condition when they had no ruler but God. The same principle is illustrated in the title, Isseroi of Asshur, borne by the Assyrian kings, who, however, with the exception of two or three individuals, never claimed to be more than viceroy of their god. Such, indeed, is the course of all idolatry, and the origin of kingship in the world. It was followed even by the people whom God had brought out of Egypt. For the arch-deceiver seduced men into idolatry, and from idolatry into monarchy, in order that he might gain supremacy over them and exact obedience to himself, and prohibit by force the service of God. For the service of the gods was always the service of devils. Egypt was the first of the kingdoms of the world that Satan used to put this wicked principle systematically into practice. And thus it is that in the scriptures, Egypt stands forever as a symbol of all that is opposed to God. The whole of the history of Egypt during the first centuries is confined to her own proper limits in the valley of the Nile. There were invasions from Ethiopia which she was obliged to repel. These were followed by invasions of Ethiopia which ended in the complete conquest of that country by the forces of Egypt. There were also occasional conflicts on the other borders, the Sinaitic Peninsula, in defense of her copper mines there, and Arabia Petraea and southern Palestine on the northeast. There was an invasion of Egypt also, and a total subjugation of the country for hundreds of years, by a vast horde from the countries of the northeast, led by the Hittites. These invaders were called by the Egyptians Ixos, which means shepherds. They devastated Egypt from the Mediterranean to Thebes, and perhaps to Elephantine. They wrought such ruin of every kind everywhere, massacring the men, enslaving the women and children, burning the cities, and razing the temples, that they made forever the very idea of a shepherd an abomination unto the Egyptians. Genesis 46-34, their capital was Tanis, the Zoan of the Bible. Ezekiel 30-14, Ums was the king under whose leadership the yoke of the shepherds was broken, and by whom Egypt was delivered from their dreadful rule. The history of Egypt during the time of the rule of the shepherds is practically a blank. Because when they were expelled, the Egyptians swept away, so far as possible, every memorial of them. The devastation that the shepherds themselves wrought at their entrance into Egypt was more than repeated by the Egyptians when they had expelled the shepherds. The only certain fact we can mention is that no one monument remains to teach us what became of the ancient splendor of Egypt under the Hyksos. And this silence even tells the calamities Egypt underwent. The time of the reigns of Ums and Amenhotep, or Amenophis I, the son and immediate successor of Ums, about 40 years, 1820-1780 BC, was fully occupied in bringing the restored kingdom to a condition of governmental order, and extending the power of Egypt over Ethiopia. Thothmes I, the third king after the expulsion of the shepherds, was the one in whom Egypt began to indulge the ambition for empire. His time was about 1780-1745. T. This period of their history, the Egyptians for the first time carried their arms deep into Asia, overrunning Syria, and even invading Mesopotamia, or the tract between the Tigris and the Euphrates. Hitherto the farthest point reached in this direction had been Shuruhan in southern Palestine, a city assigned afterward to the tribe of Simeon by Joshua. Invaders from the lower Mesopotamian region had from time to time made their appearance in the broad Syrian valleys and plains, had drunk the waters of the Orontes and the Jordan, ravaged the open country, and even, perhaps, destroyed the towns. But Syria was hitherto almost an undiscovered region to the powerful people which, nurturing its strength in the Nile Valley, had remained content with its own natural limits, and scarcely grasped at any conquests. Time was now come when this comparative quietude and absence of ambition were about to cease. Provoked by the attack made upon her from the side of Asia, and smarting from the wounds inflicted upon her pride and her prosperity by the Hyksos during the period of their rule, Egypt now set herself to retaliate, and for 3 centuries continued at intervals to pour her armies into the eastern continent, and to carry fire and sword over the extensive and populous regions which lay between the Mediterranean and the Zagros mountain range. There is some uncertainty as to the extent of her conquests, but no reasonable doubt can be entertained that for a space of 300 years Egypt was the most powerful and the most aggressive state that the world contained, and held a dominion that has as much right to be called an empire as the Assyrian, the Babylonian, or the Persian. While Babylonia, ruled by Arab conquerors, declined in strength, and Assyria proper was merely struggling into independence, Egypt put forth her arms, and grasped the fairest regions of the earth's surface. Thus commenced that struggle for predominance between northeastern Africa and southwestern Asia, which lasted for above 1,000 years, and was scarcely terminated until Rome appeared upon the scene and reduced both the rivals under her worldwide sway. As before stated, this work was begun by Thothmes I, but before attempting to follow his expeditions in Asia, it will be well to know the names and positions of the countries and their peoples, which, according to the Egyptian records, were found there. He shall then be able to judge what were the facilities and what the obstacles found by the pharaohs in the way of their enterprises. Immediately on the northeast frontier of Egypt, the desert between it and Syria was occupied by Bedouin tribes, whom the hieroglyphic inscriptions always call Shasu. The most important of these, and the nearest to Egypt, were the Amalekites of the Bible, the Amalek of the Arabian historians, though this name applied equally to the Edomites, or Edomites, and Midianites, who are sometimes mentioned among the Shasu, and even generally to all the nomadic tribes of the desert. Palestine was entirely in the hands of the Canaanites, who, after the defeat of the shepherds, were unable to form a powerful monarchy, but were in the divided state in which Joshua found them when, a little later, he conducted the Hebrews into that country. They formed an almost infinite number of petty principalities. Every city had its own king, often in rivalry with, or hostile to, his neighbors. This state of division and local isolation made Palestine an easy prey to every conqueror, for it hardly permitted them to unite against a common enemy. But at the same time it rendered a complete and perfect conquest of the country difficult, for it was necessarily favorable to partial insurrections, incessantly liable to break out. The Syrian populations, who, to the north of the Canaanites, occupied the provinces called in the Bible by the general name of Aram, as far as the river Euphrates, belonged to the confederation of the Rotenu, or Retenu, extending beyond the river and embracing all Mesopotamia Naharana. What we have already said of the Cushites may be applied to this confederation. The Rotenu had no well-defined territory, nor even a decided unity of race. They already possessed powerful cities, such as Nineveh and Babylon. But there were still many nomadic tribes within the ill-defined limits of the confederacy. Their name was taken from the city of Rezin, apparently the most ancient, and originally the most important city of Assyria. The germ of the Rotenu confederation was formed by the Semitic Assyro-Chaldean people, who were not yet welded into a compact monarchy, but were an aggregation of petty states, each having its own sovereign, and united by ties of a nature unknown to us. The first great Chaldean empire was in fact at this moment so crippled in power that the last descendants of its early kings, reduced to the possession of Babylon, and perhaps even to Erech, the first seat of their power, were nothing more than mere members of the Rotenu Confederacy. With the Assyro-Chaldeans, who were at its head, were joined in this confederation the Arameans on both sides of the Euphrates, whom history shows to have been always friendly to, and in strict alliance with, Assyria. The mountains to the north of Mesopotamia were inhabited by the Ramanan, or Armenians, of the Japhetic race. In Ali, west of the Rotenu, in the valley of the Orontes and the vast space contained between the left bank of the Euphrates, the Taurus, and the sea, that Canaanitish tribe, apparently always the strongest and most powerful, the Kidus, or Hittites, a small branch of whom remained in Palestine near Hebron, had founded a warlike and formidable empire, a strongly centralized monarchy. But the power of the Hittite kingdom does not seem to have been sufficiently great to be dreaded by the Egyptians, and it is not until the time of the following dynasty that we see them playing a considerable part in the affairs of Western Asia. The first of the military expeditions of Thutmose was conducted to the southward into Ethiopia and Nubia. Several battles were fought, in one of which, his captain general says, His Majesty became more furious than a panther, and with an arrow himself succeeded in wounding the chief of his enemies so that he was made a prisoner. He declares that he and of Nubia were hewed in pieces, and scattered all over their lands till air stench filled the valleys. T. Last a general submission was made, and a large tract of territory was ceded. The Egyptian frontier was pushed on from Samolot 21050, to Tombozlot 1900. And a memorial was set up at the latter place to mark the existing extent of the empire southward. A new officer was appointed to govern the newly annexed country, who was called he ruler of Cush, and appears to have resided at Samu. When he had firmly fixed his power in the south, Thutmose marched into Asia. Palestine was overrun, and the Canaanites were brought into submission. He then invaded Aram, as he says, for the purpose of taking satisfaction upon the countries. In the neighborhood of Damascus he met and defeated a large force of the Rotenu. Having subdued the Rotenu of Aram, he next crossed the Euphrates at Carchemish, and through long series of battles conquered the Rotenu of Aram. Naharaim single captain boasts that in the course of the expedition he took 21 hands, or, in other words, killed 21 men, besides capturing a horse and a chariot. If one man could do so much, what must have been the amount of injury inflicted by the entire host? Egyptian armies, according to Manetho, were counted by hundreds of thousands. And even if for hundreds we substitute ends, the result must have been a carnage and a desolation sufficiently distressing. He returned to Egypt with great booty and many captives, and set up a tablet on which he recorded his exploits. Thothmes II was the son and successor of Thothmes I. His reign was very short. He made one expedition against the Arabs in the northern parts of the Sinaitic Peninsula, and spent the rest of his short reign with his sister Hatasu in building temples to their gods. Hatasu is supposed to have been the cause of the very short reign of Thothmes II. Because during the minority of her younger brother, then about 5 years old, she made herself the ruler of Egypt, not as regent but in fact, occupying the throne herself and allowing the brother a seat upon her footstool. She also erased the name of Thothmes II from his monuments, and put her own name or her father's name in its place. She wore man clothing, and adopted the title of Ing. He is constantly represented upon the monuments, in male attire, often crowned with the tall plumes of Amun. She calls herself He Son of the Sun, He Good God, He Lord of the Two Lands, the Lobed of Amun-Ra, the God of Kings, and His Majesty herself. As a builder she did indeed succeed in attaining a distinction equal to that of the kings themselves. She set up at Karnak two obelisks, each 100 feet tall and weighing 368 tons, which, she says, was accomplished in 7 months from the time the stone was cut in the quarries of Syene. By a friendly expedition down the Red Sea to the land of Punt, Yemen, or Arabia Felix, she secured the recognition of the suzerainty of Egypt over that country fertile and rich in itself, and which, being the depot of Indian commerce, was the object of the desires of the Egyptian monarchy, as the possession of it was necessarily an almost inexhaustible source of wealth. Among the articles of commerce obtained in this one expedition, she names incense, gold, silver, ivory, ebony, cassia, coal, or stibium, apes, baboons, dogs, slaves, and leopard skins. She declared, "Ever had a convoy been made like this one by any king since the creation of the world, and that nothing similar to this expedition had been won in the times of a former king in this country eternally." When Hatasu died, after a reign of about 22 years, she was succeeded by her younger brother whom she had kept in a subordinate position all the time. Thothmes III was the title which this king bore. He showed his resentment of the conduct of Hatasu by attempting a systematic erasure of her name from her monumental records. His purpose was not fully accomplished, because the persons employed to do it failed to cut deep enough. And so her history has been made out without much difficulty. He did, however, completely exclude her name from the list of sovereigns, by dating his own reign alone from the death of his brother. This gives him a reign of 54 years, about 1742 to 1688 BC. The young king was certainly a man of very strong individuality. For in spite of the constant curbing and humiliation that was put upon him by the masculine Hatasu through all the years of his early life, he became one of the greatest of Egyptian kings, and beyond a doubt the greatest of Egyptian conquerors. No later monarch ever exceeded his glories. Thothmes III is the nearest approach to the ideal Sesostris, the only pharaoh who really penetrated with a hostile force deep into the heart of Assyria, and forced the great states of Western Asia to pay him tribute, if not even to acknowledge his suzerainty. Before the first year of his sole reign had ended, in the month of Tharmuthi, he began his military career by the invasion of Palestine, with the intent, as he himself says, of extending the frontiers of Egypt by his victories. He says that the people from Sharon to Jericho are coming to rebel against his majesty. On the fifth day of the month Paschens he entered Gaza in triumph. After 11 days he took his way on the 16th of Paschens to the fortress of Jamnia. As he proceeded from there he escorted with his brave troops, telling them that the vile enemies he was sure would be found concentrated at Megiddo. In this he was correct, for, then at the moment, this they had done. By scouts he learned that he chiefs of the countries from the waters river of Egypt to the places of Naharina Mesopotamia with the Hittites, had concentrated in the plain of Esdraelon the fortress which is in Makkada Megiddo. They were also guarding the main roads through Ajalon to Tanach. The officers of the army of Thothmes advised that he march his army up the coast, and by a circuitous route enter the plain of Esdraelon from the north. Upon the chance that those who were guarding the passes would not fight, he decided to take the direct road through Ajalon to Tanach, and enter the plain of Esdraelon and the face of the allied hosts. His calculations were correct. For without difficulty he reached the Lake of Keen, a little south of Megiddo, about noon on the 21st of Passions. There his majesty pitched his tent to make a speech before his whole army, saying, "Aston you, put on your helmets, for I shall fly to fight with the vile enemy on the morning." Therefore was a rest at the doors of the king tent made by the baggage of the chiefs, things of the followers, and supplies. Was passed the watchword of the army, who say, "Erm, firm, watch, watch, watch actively," at the king pavilion. The land of Meru, and those born of the south and north upper and lower Egypt have come to address his majesty Oriover on the 22nd day of the month Passions, the day of the festival of the new moon and laying the royal crown. On the morning then in presence of the entire army, was passed the watchword. His majesty proceeding in his chariot of gold, distinguished by the decorations of work, like the terrible Horus the Lord who makes things, like Mentu, Lord of Ass. The southern horn right wing of the army of his majesty was at the shore of the Lake of Kena-Keen, the northern horn extending to the northwest of Makeda-Megiddo. His majesty being in the midst of them, the god Amen being the protection in his active limbs, he wounding them with his arms, his majesty prevailed over them before his army. They saw his majesty prevailing over them, they fell prostrate on the plains of Makeda on their faces through terror. They left their horses, their chariots of gold and silver which drew them, and were dragged by the entanglement of their clothes to that fortress. The men shut up in that fortress took off their clothes to haul them up to that fortress. The troops of his majesty took no heed of capturing the things of the fallen. The army reached Makeda at the moment when the vile enemy of Kateshu and the vile enemy of the fortress were striving to let them enter the fortress. His majesty frightened them. He prevailed by his diadem over them. Their horses and their chariots of gold and of silver were captured, were brought to his majesty. Their dead lay in ranks like fishes on the ground. The victorious army of his majesty turned back to count the things captured, and the camp was captured, his whole army in joy giving thanks, giving glory to Amen for what he had given to his son. The troops of his majesty praising his power. They were bringing the spoil they took of hands, living captives, horses, chariots of silver and gold. Living captives 340, hands 83, mares 2041, fillies 191, stallions 6, chariots plated with gold, an ark of gold of the enemy, an excellent chariot plated with gold of the chief, 892 chariots of his vile army, total 924. One excellent suit of bronze armor of the enemy, a bronze suit of armor of the chief of Makeda, 200 suits of armor of his vile army, 502 bells his delight, 7 poles of the pavilion of the enemy plated with silver. This defeat of such a great force and the capture of Megiddo he counted equal to the capture of 1,000 other fortresses. For the result was that very chief of the countries and rebellious places came into it making their submission. And the chiefs of that land came, bringing the usual tribute, adoring the spirits of his majesty, asking breath for their nostrils of the greatness of his power and the importance of his spirits, having their tribute of silver, gold, lapis lazuli, turquoise, and alabaster, vessels of wine, flocks. The army of his majesty made the prisoners bear the tribute in the galley. That is, the spoil was brought down to the sea and placed in the galleys of the Egyptian fleet to be transported to Egypt and the capital of the king. And the army took bulls 1949, she-goats 2,000, white-goats 20,500. The total amount of things led behind by his majesty from the things of the place of the enemy who was in the land of the Rutan, from the fortress of Nuna, from the fortress of Anukasa, from Harankar, with the things which belonged to the fortresses, placed in the water's eye. In the ships and the waters 38 of their family, 87 sons of chiefs of the enemy, and of the leaders with him 5, Other slaves, male and female including children 1796, prisoners who surrendered, starved out of the enemy 103. Total 2503, besides gems, gold dishes, and various vases, a great cup, the work of the Crusarians, dishes, various vases, for drinking, having great stands. 97 swords weighing 1784 pounds, golden rings found in the hands of the workmen, and silver in many rings, 966 pounds, 1 ounce. A silver statue, the head of gold, seats of men, of ivory, ebony, and cedar, inlaid with gold, chairs of the enemy 6, footstools belonging to them 6, large tables of ivory and cedar inlaid with gold and all precious stones, a stick in the shape of a scepter of that chief inlaid with gold throughout. Statues of the fallen chief, of ebony inlaid with gold, of which the heads are of gold, vessels of bronze, add an infinite quantity of the clothes of the enemy. When the fields of the district were taken to calculate their produce to the king house, to lay down their quota, the total of the quantity brought to his majesty from the plains of Makeda was 208,000 bushels of corn, besides what was cut and taken away. Such was the result of the first campaign of Thothmes III. And in the course of the next 17 years it was followed by 13 others. For in the 39th year his majesty was in the land of the Rotenu in his 14th campaign. None of these will be followed in detail as it would be largely repetition. In his second campaign he crossed the Euphrates at Carchemish. Seeing the importance of that point as the key of the east, he built there a strong fortress, the ruins of which are still to be seen. The princes of the east sent their tribute without attempting battle. Among the chiefs whom he names as bringing tribute, are he king of Nineveh and the king of Asher. He left a list of more than 300 names of cities, towns, and districts that he conquered. More than 100 of these were in Palestine. And more than 20 of these are places mentioned in Genesis, Joshua, and Judges. Such as Dothan, Genesis 34-17. Karta, Joshua, 21-34. The land of Tob, Judges 11-5, Ashtoreth Carnum, Genesis 14-5. Lash, Judges 18-7. Hazor, Joshua 11-1. Judges 4-2. Chinrith, Joshua 19-35. Adama, Joshua 19-36. Kishon, Joshua 19-20. Mishael, Joshua 19-26. Akshup, Joshua 19-25. Taanach, Judges 5-19. Iblim, Joshua 17-11. Acho, Judges 1-31. Beth Shemesh, Joshua 19-22. Anaharath, Joshua 19-19. Haphraim, Joshua 10-19. Nob, Joshua 19-33. Soko, Joshua 15-35. Migdal-Gad, Joshua 15-37. Jerusalem, by the term Aral corresponding to Real, and signifying He Mount of the Lord, Genesis 22-14. Rabbah, Joshua 15-60. Vale of Hebron, Genesis 37-14. Helkoth, Joshua 21-31. When his conquests were completed, his dominion embraced Ethiopia, Nubia, Libya, Cyprus, and the isles in the midst of the Great Sea. He circuited of the Great Sea, Arabia, Moab, Ammon, Palestine, Phoenicia, Syria, Asia Minor, the land of the Hittites, Armenia, Mesopotamia, Assyria, Iraq, Babylonia, a strange people of Asia, and a country called the Land of Nay, where he hunted 120 elephants on account of their tusks, and which therefore must have been well toward India, for there were no elephants in Assyria or Babylonia, nor in the parts of Africa with which he had to do. 42. All these nations brought tribute to Thothmes III. The sons and brothers of the chiefs were kept at the court of the king of Egypt, and when any of the chiefs died, his successor was at free to occupy the place. Under Thothmes III, Egypt attained to the summit of her power. In internal affairs, a wise foresight and administration ensured everywhere order and progress. Abroad, Egypt became by her victories the arbitress of the whole civilized world. Thus it was not altogether exaggeration when he put into the mouth of his God the statement, "Here is not any rebel to thee in the circle of heaven, they come bearing their tribute on their backs beseeching thy majesty." One of his principal generals closes the record of his career thus, "O, the king ended the time of his existence of many good years of victory and power, and was made justified. Commencing at the first year and ending at the 54th year, in the month Famnith, of the reign of the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Ra-Min-Kippur. Justified, he ascended to heaven, and joined the sun disk, a divine follower, urgent in doing, it shone to him as the morning, he was the disk of the sun coming out of the heaven. Thothmes III, also, was a great builder. He also set up wonderful obelisks. Two of these, he says, were 108 cubits 162 feet in height. Two others, one of which stands in Rome, in front of the church of St. John Lateran, were 105 feet in heights on this one in Rome. Among much other like matter, is a line running, "He son of the sun, Thothmes III, giver of life like the sun forever." The obelisk that stands in Central Park, New York City, was originally set up by Thothmes III. And yet another stands on the remains of the ancient hippodrome at Constantinople. Amenophis II was the son and successor of Thothmes III. He reigned only about 7 or 8 years, 1688 to 1680 BC. But he was successful in confirming the power of Egypt over all the regions that his father had conquered, and which had struck for independence immediately upon the death of Thothmes III. He says that he fought with his enemies in the land of Asher. And on one of his monuments he is pictured receiving tribute from Mesopotamia. In order to give a lasting lesson to rebellious kings, at one place in northern Syria he had 7 of the revolted kings brought before him, all of whom he himself slew there with his own battle club. He then took the 7 corpses down to the sea, and fastened them to the prows of his warships, and so brought them to Egypt. Having reached his capital, he hung 6 of the 7 bodies outside the walls of Thebes, and the other one he took to Nubia and suspended it upon the wall of Napata, the capital of that country, in order, as he says, that the Negroes might see the victories of the ever-living king over all lands and all people upon earth, since he had possessed the people of the south and chastised the people of the north. On one of his monuments are represented 11 captured kings. Thothmes IV was the son and successor of Amenophis II. His reign continued only about 8 or 9 years, 1680 to 1672 BC. And but 2 military expeditions are recorded in it. One of these was against the Hittites of Syria, and the other against the Cushites or people of Ethiopia. He took great pleasure in hunting the lion and in other field sports, and was very proud of his fast horses. He declares that the horses which he usually drove to his chariot were swifter than the wind, and that when he overtook people on the road, he passed them so quickly that they could not recognize him. He attributed his sovereignty to the special favor of the god Harmachis, whom he identified with the great Sphinx of the pyramids. He says that the god spoke to his one day as he rested and slept in its shadow at noon, told him that he should be king of Egypt, and asked him to take away the sand that had partially covered it. This is his story in his own words, and one of these days the royal son, Thothmes, being arrived, while walking at midday and seating himself under the shadow of this mighty god, was overcome by a slumber and slept at the very moment when Ra is at the summit of heaven. He found that the majesty of this august god spoke to him with his own mouth, as a father speaks to his son, saying, "Look upon me, contemplate me, O my son Thothmes. I am thy father, Harmachis Khopri Ra-Tum. I bestow upon thee the sovereignty over my domain, the supremacy over the living. Thou shalt wear its white crown and its red crown on the throne of Seb, the hereditary chief. May the earth be your in all its length and breadth. May the splendor of the universal master illumine thee. May there come unto thee the abundance that is in the double land, the riches brought from every country and the long duration of years. Thine is my face, yours is my heart. Thy heart is mine. Behold my actual condition that thou mayest protect all my perfect limbs. The sand of the desert whereon I am laid has covered me. Save me, causing all that is in my heart to be executed. For I know that thou art my son, my avenger. Approach, behold, I am with thee. Afterward the prince awakened, he understood the word of this God and kept silence in his heart. In accordance with what he had dreamed, after he became king he caused to be cleared away from about the Sphinx the accumulation of the sands of centuries. And when the work had been completed, he formed a small temple 10x5 feet at the end of the passage between the paws, and immediately under the chin of the Sphinx. In this temple he placed a stele 7 feet 2 inches in breadth, and 11 feet 10 inches in heights, on which he inscribed the account of his dream which we have here quoted, with ascriptions in honor of his gods and in praise of himself. He married a daughter of Ardatama, king of the country of Mitanni, the Aram Naharim of the Bible. Amenophis III was the son and successor or Thothmes IV. He reigned at least 36 years. For there is an inscription of his bearing that date. This would make his date about 1672 to 1636 BC. The terrible lesson given by Amenophis II among the revolted kings in the northeast seems to have been effectual, as the kings of the different countries made their submission and sent their presents without any warlike demonstration on the part of Amenophis III. His military exploits seem to have been altogether displayed in forays into the south and to capture Negroes to be made slaves. As a builder, however, Amenophis III ranks with the leading monarchs of Egypt. He covered the banks of the Nile with monuments remarkable for their grandeur, and for the perfection of the sculptures with which they are adorned. The temple at Jebel Barkal, the ancient Napata, capital of Egyptian Ethiopia, is the work of this reign, as well as that of Sobe near the Third Cataract. At Syene, Elephantine, Silsilis, Eleithia, in the Serapeum of Memphis, and in the Sinaitic Peninsula, works of Amenhotep III are found. He made considerable additions to the temple at Karnak, and built that part of the temple of Luxor now covered by the houses of the village of that name. The dedicatory inscription which he placed on it deserves to be inserted as a specimen of the customary style and title of Egyptian sovereigns. He is Horus, the strong bull, who rules by the sword and destroys all barbarians. He is king of Upper and Lower Egypt, absolute master, son of the sun. He strikes down the chiefs of all lands, no country can stand before his face. He marches and victory is gained, like Horus son of Isis, like the sun in heaven. He overturns even their fortresses. He brings to Egypt by his valor, tribute from many countries. He, the lord of both worlds, son of the sun. On the bank of the Nile opposite Luxor, in front of a temple which he built there, he set up 2 colossal sitting figures of himself which still stand there, a wonder to all who behold them. They were both cut bodily from the quarry, each one a single block 68 feet 4 inches in height when finished. The storms of the ages have worn away the tall crowns that were originally upon the heads, so that now they are only about 60 feet in height. The sculptor who carved them says of his work, "Immortalize the name of the king. And no one has done the like of me in my works. I executed 2 portrait statues of the king, astonishing for their breadth and height. Dash their completed form dwarfed the temple tower, 40 cubits was their measure. They were cut in the splendid sandstone mountain, on each side the eastern and the western. I caused to be built 8 ships, whereon the statues were carried up the river. They were emplaced in their sublime building. They will last as long as heaven. A joyful event was it when they were landed at Thebes and raised up in their place. Like his father, Amenophis III took a wife from the family of the king of the country of Mitanni. In his 10th year he married Kirgipa, the daughter of Sutorna, the successor of Ardatama. He says she was sent to Egypt with he chief of her women 317 persons. Whether Kirgipa died soon is not known. At any rate he sent to Dusrata, king of Mitanni, the son and successor of Sutorna, and received for his chief wife the king daughter Taiye. King Dusrata wrote 2 letters to Amenophis III regarding this transaction. The first one reads as follows, O Nimra! The great king, the king of Egypt, my brother, my son-in-law, whom I love and who loves me, speak thus, Dusrata, the great king, the king of the country of Mitanni, thy brother, thy father-in-law, and who loves thee. Unto me is peace, Unto my brother and unto my son-in-law may there be peace. To thy houses, to thy wives, to thy sons, to thy men, to thy chariots, to thy horses, to thy country, and to thy property, may there be abundant peace. If my brother whom I love, the wife, my daughter, I deliver to him, may the sun god and I star march before my brother, according to the heart of my brother may they act, and may my brother on this same day rejoice, may the sun god and I star hear the prayer of my brother, abundant joy to my brother may they give, and may my brother live forever in peace. Ain, the messenger of my brother, and Cain, the dragoman of my brother, like a god thou didst send. Many presents didst thou give them, thou didst honor them greatly on account of their letter, counting on their service. The men who really live if at any time I see not, may my gods and the gods of my brother protect them. O Nakramasi, whom thou hast seen, to transact business with my brother I send. And also one necklace of crystal and alabaster, and some gold, for a present to my brother, I have dispatched. And for 100,000 years for the service of my brother may they be used. A second letter, giving further particulars, runs thus, O Nimra'a, the great king, the king of Egypt, my brother, my son-in-law, who loves me and whom I love, it is said as follows, Dusrata the great king, thy father-in-law, who loves thee, the king of Mitanni, thy brother. Unto myself is peace. Unto thee may there be peace, to thy house, to my sister, and to the rest of thy wives, to thy sons, to thy chariots, to thy horses, to thy nobles, to thy country, and to thy property may there be abundant peace. Until the time of thy fathers, they with my fathers were in closest alliance. Since then, thou hast perfected it and with my father were in exceedingly close alliance. Now thou, since thou and I love one another, has established it 10 times more than in my father time. May the gods direct us, and this our alliance may remain my lord and Amunim forever as now confirm. And when my brother sent Main, his ambassador, saying, My brother, let thy daughter be my wife and mistress of the land of Egypt, I did not vex the heart of my brother, and spoke publicly according to his wish, and her whom my brother asked for I showed to Main, and he saw her. When he had seen her, he much approved of her. And in peace in the country of my brother may I know her. May I star and Amunim according to the heart of my brother advise her. Ilya, my messenger, reported unto me the words of my brother. When I heard them it was very good, I rejoiced very exceedingly, saying, Verily unto me has this favor happened, and whereas in consequence of the alliance that was between us, we loved each other, now in consequence of these words, we shall love each other forever. Further, the letter speaks of the dowry and the gold Dutch gold which the king of Egypt had sent to Dusrata's father, and to him. Only he hopes that the king will send to him much more than was sent to his father. Indeed, he would like to have so much gold that it will not be counted. The letter then closes as follows, O for a present to my brother, one goblet of gold set with crystals around its cup. One heavy necklace of 20 crystal beads, and 19 beads of gold, in its center a crystal amulet encased in gold. One heavy necklace of 42 Kalalu stones and 40 gold beads, the metal of which is of I-star, and in its center an amulet of Kalalu stone, cased in gold. 10 pairs of horses. 10 chariots of wood, together with their furniture, and 30 eunuchs. I have sent for a present to my brother. Yet another letter gives another particular as to this marriage. This part of the letter reads as follows, Ain, the ambassador of my brother, went to demand a wife for my brother, that he might take her to be queen of Egypt. And the letter which he took I read, and to his message listened my good heart attentively, and the words of my brother, as the person of my brother, I saw and rejoiced on that day very exceedingly. Day and night it produced pleasure and all the words of my brother which Main took to me, I performed in the same year. Again, the wife of my brother, the queen of Egypt, I have dispatched to my brother. But I did not cause them to go up to Egypt to convey my daughter that she might be the wife of my brother even now I did not cause them to go up. After 6 months Gilea, my ambassador, and Main, the ambassador of my brother, I dismissed. The wife of my brother to be queen of Egypt, my daughter to my brother they brought. Maybeltis, the lady of battle, my goddess, and Amenu, the god of my brother, according to his heart advise him. Compare this letter with the 24th chapter of Genesis, and especially verse 55 with the margin. When, about 200 years before this, Abraham's servant went to this same country to find a wife for Isaac, and when Rebekah had been chosen, her parents asked that she might abide with them full year or at least 10 months. But in view of the clear leading of the Lord, the servants asked that she might go immediately. As an evidence of his great love to the king, Dusrata emphasizes the fact that he had sent his daughter in the same year in which she was asked for, and had detained her only 6 months. When Tai reached Egypt and the king saw her for himself, he was greatly pleased with her. He rejoiced with exceeding fullness, and declared, "And the joy of my heart I will give her all her desire." And he caused her to be united publicly with his country. She is represented as having Hittite hair, blue eyes, and rosy cheeks. He prized her so highly that he not only made her the chief of all his wives and queen of Egypt, but he showed her considerable deference in the affairs of the government. Amenophis IV was the son of Amenophis III, by the lady Tai, the daughter of Dusrata, king of Mitanni. He reigned about 12 years, 1636 to 1624 BC. No sooner was he come to the throne than he too sent to King Dusrata for a wife. The old king was much pleased with this additional token of regard from the kingdom of Egypt, and sent a long letter to Amenophis IV, in which he gives the family relations between the two kingdoms for three generations back. His words are as follows: "O Nafkharia, my son-in-law, whom I love and who loves me, Dusrata, the great king, the king of Mitanni, thy brother, thy father-in-law, who loves thee, unto me is peace. To thee and Tai, thy mother, and Tatakhepa, my daughter, thy wife, may there be peace. To may there be peace. To thy sons, to thy nobles, to thy chariots, to thy horses, to thy country, and to thy property may there be exceeding peace. Send an embassy to Nimrata, and thy father sent to me, and as regards the message which he sent, there was no word whatsoever which was concealed from the ambassadors of thy father whom he sent to me. And Tai, the chief wife of thy father, thy mother, knew them all, he showed them to Tai. She favored all of them, and after them thy father repeated the words which he had spoken with Meomenakbiathothans IV, the father of Nimrata, sent to Artatama, the father of my father, and the daughter of Artatama, the father of my father, he asked for, 5 times, 6 times he sends, but Artatama did not give her. At last his daughter he sends, and with the train of handmaids he gave her. An embassy from Nimrata Amenophis III, thy father, to Suturna, my father, came, and the daughter of my father, my darling sister, though he asked for her and 7 times requested her, my father did not give. At last 5 times and 6 times he sends, and my father gave her with the train of handmaids. And Nimrata, thy father, sent to me, and when he asked for my daughter, I did not refuse, but I spoke favorably. To his messenger I speak as follows, am ready to give her. Thy messenger among my children has come, and my eyes have seen the AQQATI which he has given, and her dowry is worthy of yourself, and I will bestow on her the dowry due to Nimrata, thy father, which contains jewels such as no god possesses. And because I am honored I do not refuse to give her. And Amasis, the ambassador of my brother, who had come for the bride, I sent back to Nimrata after 3 months, with a very costly present, such as none had given before, and a goblet of gold was given, which I dispatched. Telas my daughter I gave to him, and when I had dispatched her, and when Nimrata, thy father, had seen her, he rejoiced with exceeding fullness, and my brother speaks as follows, and the joy of my heart I will give her all her desire. And he caused her to be united publicly with his country. And moreover my ambassador he honored like men. When he had seen him, and he honored him, And ever did Nimrod replace him in the front rank. Tai knows the truth of what I speak, and asked Tai, thy mother, if among the words which I speak there is one word of falsehood. Him did Nimrod, thy father, honor, and Nimrod, thy father, made brotherhood and league with me, and now they say that Nimrod has died, and what they have said has distracted my heart, and I wept on that day. On my throne I did not sit. Bread and water on that day I did not take, and I was sad, and I said, if he is dead, in the land of my beloved sister and among my servants are the objects of gold, and his son will succeed him, and he loves me. Or if he is alive with the God, and we love one another, and on that account in our hearts we are not distant from each other, and now to me, the eldest son of Nimrod, by Tai his wife, has made offers of alliance and brotherhood and has spoken thus, Imra is not dead since Nafkharura, his eldest son by Tai, his chief wife, sits in his place, and will never at all alter his words from their place, but they shall remain as before. Something seems to have occurred that somewhat offended the king of Egypt, for another letter was sent by Dusrata complaining that his ambassadors had not been respected, and begging for restoration of the former friendly relations. Following is the letter, O Nafkharura, the king of Egypt, my brother, my son-in-law, who loves me, and whom I love, it is said as follows, Dusrata, king of the country of Mitanni, thy father-in-law, who loves thee, speaks thus, unto myself is peace, unto thee may there be peace, unto thy houses, Tai, thy mother, and the land of Egypt, to Tatakhepa, my daughter, thy wife, to the rest of thy wives, to thy sons, to thy soldiers and thy chariots, to thy horses, to thy men, to thy country, and to all that thou hast, may there be very abundant peace. Irtsi and Pupri, my ambassadors, I have sent to my brother to explain, and have addressed them with great trouble and earnestness, and I have sent them in a body. And this speech beforehand I make to my brother, Main, thy ambassador, I detain, and Umidu, my messenger. I will dismiss, and the prophet shall go to the end. Now my brother to their own land has not permitted them to go, but has detained them overmuch. Wherefore has he not protected the ambassadors? They have fled, and there is guilt on my brother in respect of the ambassadors. Why is his heart angered? Why has he spoken before the fact? Pupur has not returned, and he has spoken. His offers of alliance he does not listen to. Yet I, O son-in-law, am verily thy father-in-law, and as regards the frequent intercourse which with thy father I had, Tai, thy mother, knows the facts. No one else knows the facts. But after Tai, thy mother, thou knowest them and what he said to thee. As thy father with me was friendly, so now, O my brother, again with me thou art friendly, and what is contrary thereto, no one, O my brother, listens to. The conquered kingdoms and peoples remained submissive, and sent their presents to Amenophis IV at his accession, as to his predecessor. Even the strong kingdoms of Babylon and Assyria sent presents to Egypt, and her suzerainty was still recognized there. This we know by letters from the kings of those countries. At Tel El Amarna, in Upper Egypt, in the year 1887, there were found a number of tablets containing copies of letters and dispatches from the kings and governors of Babylonia and Assyria, Syria, Mesopotamia, and eastern Cappadocia, of Phoenicia and Palestine to the kings of Egypt, the most of them to Amenophis III and Amenophis IV. The letters from Dusrata, already quoted, are from this collection. Among these also are one letter from Ashur-Eubalid, king of Assyria, and two from Burnabrias, king of Babylon, to Amenophis IV, king of Egypt. These letters show that both these kings and their fathers paid tribute, sent presents to the king, Amenophis IV, of Egypt, and his fathers. The letter of King Ashur-Eubalid runs as follows, O Nafkharia-Niferu-Kipper-Ra, the great king, the king of Egypt, my brother, I write thus, even I, Ashur-Eubalid, king of the country of Assyria, the great king, thy brother. To thyself, to thy house, and thy country may there be peace. That I have seen thy ambassadors has pleased me greatly. Thy ambassadors I have sent for to appear in my presence. A chariot, the choicest in the kingdom, with its harness and two white horses, together with one chariot without harness, and a seal of white alabaster, I have dispatched as a present to thee. For the great king is produced perpetually the gold which in thy country is like the dust that they collect. Why in thy presence is it brought and kept back? Is it withheld and not sent? All the gold that is my property, as well as what is lacking to it, send. Henasurnadinaki, my father, sent an embassy to the country of Egypt. Mitsri, 20 talents of gold did they dispatch to him. When the king of the country of Kani Rabbitah to thy father and the land of Egypt sent an embassy, 20 talents of gold did they dispatch to him. As to the king of Kani Rabbitah, so also to myself dispatch the gold. The road both in going and returning for the hands of my ambassadors I have made secure. If thou inclinest thy face favorably, dispatch much gold, and thy letter in return write to me, and what thou desirest let them take. Behold, distant lands have the ambassadors visited and they have journeyed to many cities. As for thy ambassadors they have delayed on the way because the Suti threatened them with death, until I sent and the Uti took fright. My ambassadors. Them and they did not delay. When the ambassadors reach the frontier of Assyria, why do they not wait? And at the frontier they are in a hurry. It is fitting at the frontier they should wait for the king, everything is there and he has established it, and at the frontier he has arranged it. Against the king who fulfills everything, there is no charge. Why at the frontier are they in a hurry, even the ambassadors who? King Burnaburias of Babylon wrote as follows, O Nefkuriya, king of the country of Egypt, by letter I speak, even I Burnaburias, king of the country of Caradunias, thy brother unto myself is peace. To thyself, thy house, thy wives, thy children, thy country, thy officers, thy horses, and thy chariots, may there ever be peace. For since my father and thy father with one another conferred in amity, they sent beautiful presents to one another. But they did not address one another in fair and beautiful letters. Again, O my brother, 2 minas of gold I have sent as my present. In return send me abundance of gold, as much as thy father sent. Or if that is displeasing, send half of what thy father sent. Wherefore shouldst thou send 2 minas of gold only? For the sake of the folding doors in the temple of Mat and the palace which I have undertaken to build, send much gold, and whatsoever thou desirest in my country, write for and let them take it to thee. And the time of Kurigalzu, my father, the Kunakians, all of them, sent to him saying, Against the government of the country let us sin and rebel. With thee will we make a league. My father sent this answer to them saying, Ease to ask to ally thyself with me, if thou art estranged from the king of Egypt my brother, and alliest thyself with another, I will not go and assist you. Thus my father was like-minded with me, because of thy father he did not listen to them. Again, by an Assyrian who regards my face have I not sent to thee after the news I have of them, asking why they have gone to thy country. If thou lovest me, no success will they obtain. Dismiss them to their distant country or a present to thee 3 minas of alabaster, and 14 spans of horses, with 5 chariots of wood I have dispatched to thee. As his ambassadors were on their way to Egypt, they were slain, and the presents for the king of Egypt were confiscated in one of the countries through which they were to pass. As that country was subject to Egypt, King Burnaburias sent to the king of Egypt a report of it and a request that the injury be redressed. This letter is as follows, O Nefkuriya, the king of Egypt, my brother, it is spoken thus, Burnaburias, the king of Caradunias, thy brother, dash unto myself is peace. Unto thee, thy country, thy house, thy wives, thy children, thy officers, thy horses, and thy chariots, may there ever be peace. And my brother with one another have conferred amicably, and this is what we have said, as follows, as our fathers with one another, we also have friendly dealings. Again, my ministers who came with Akhidabu into the country of Kinnikhi trusted to destiny, from Akhidabu to visit my brother, they passed. In the city of Kikhanatuni of the country of Kinakhi, Samatta, the son of Balaam, and Sutatna the son of Saradam, of the city of Aku, when they had sent their men, slew my ministers and carried off their treasures which they were taking for a present to the king of Egypt. Have sent to you therefore a complainant who may speak to thee thus, Kinakhi is thy country and the king is thy servant. In thy country I have been injured. Do thou punish the offender. The silver which they carried off was a present for thee, and the men who are my servants they have slain. Slay them and requite the blood of my messengers. But if thou dost not put these men to death, the inhabitants of the high road that belongs to me will turn and verily will slay thy ambassadors, and a breach will be made in the agreement to respect the persons of ambassadors, and this man Burnaburias will be estranged from the knee of my men. Samatta having cut off his feet detained him with him, and as for another man, Sutatna of Aku having made him stand on his head he stood upon his face. As for these men, one has spoken thus, have seen indeed. What thou askest that indeed thou knowest. Why way of a present, one mane of alabaster I have dispatched to thee by my ambassadors, a costly gift I have sent to thee. On account of the report which my brother has heard, my ambassadors do not detain, the costly present let them offer to thee. In the many forms of the idolatry of Egypt, the elements of sun worship had a place. But until the time of Amenophis IV, the sun was considered as but one among the many gods of the country. True, it was considered one of the greatest, if not the greatest, of the gods. Its name A was made an element in the title of the sovereign of the land of Egypt Ph Ra O, and the king called himself He Son of the Sun, yet for all this it was but one among the many other gods. With Amenophis IV, however, there was a change made. Under the influence of four generations of Mesopotamian women, and especially of Tyi, mother of Amenophis IV, the sun had acquired a greater prominence than formerly. And now this king undertook to make the sun the only god, and sun worship the only worship, of the country. The disk of the sun by the name of Aten was the emblem of this worship. Amenophis himself changed his own name to Khuenaten, which signifies he splendor of the solar disk. In the letters to him from Palestine and Phoenicia, he is constantly addressed as the ungod. He proposed to make this disk worship he summoned substance of the state religion, and not only to devote himself to it with all the enthusiasm of a thoroughly oriental nature, but to press it upon his subjects as the proper substitute of all their ancient worships. Regular persecution broke out throughout the whole empire. The temples of the ancient gods were closed, and their images, as well as names, everywhere effaced from the monuments, especially the image and name of Amen, the supreme god of Thebes. Wishing to make an end of all the traditions of his ancestors, this reforming king abandoned Thebes and built another capital in Upper Egypt, in a place now called Tell el-Amarna. This forceful sweeping away of the gods and temples of the former worships of all kinds, this too at the dictation of foreigners, caused much disaffection among the people throughout the land. Because the whole of Egypt was so filled with idolatry of all sorts, that it was easier to find a god than a man, Egypt bore the impress of religion. Its writing was full of sacred symbols and of allusions to sacred myths, so that its use beyond the influence of Egyptian religion became, as it were, impossible. Literature and science were but branches of theology. The fine arts were only employed with a view to religion and the glorification of the gods or deified kings. The prescriptions of religion were so multiplied, so constantly repeated, that it was not possible to exercise a profession, to provide for one's subsistence, or satisfy one's commonest wants, without being constantly reminded of the laws laid down by the priests. Each province had its special gods, its peculiar rites, its sacred animals. Symbolism was the very essence of the genius of the Egyptian nation, and of their religion. The abuse of that tendency produced the grossest and most monstrous perversion of the external and popular worship in the land of Mizraim. To symbolize the attributes, the qualities, the nature of the various deities of their pantheon, the Egyptian priests had recourse to animals. The bull, the cow, the ram, the cat, the ape, crocodile, hippopotamus, hawk, ibis, scarabaeus, and others, were each emblems of a divine personage. The god was represented under the figure of that animal, or more often by the strange conjunction peculiar to Egypt, of the head of the animal with a human body. But the inhabitants of the banks of the Nile, instinctively averse to the idolatry of other pagan nations, preferred to pay their worship to living representatives of their gods rather than to lifeless images of stone or metal, and they found these representatives in the animals chosen as emblems of the idea expressed by the conception of each god. The public forms and ceremonial of their worship were as all-pervading as was the idolatry itself. The great temple of each city was the center of its life. A perpetual ceremonial of the richest kind went on within its walls, along its shady corridors, or through its sunlit courts. Long processions made their way up or down its avenues of sphinxes. Incense floated in the air. Strains of music resounded without pause. All that was brightest and most costly met the eye on every side. And the love of spectacle, if not deep religious feeling, naturally drew to the sanctuary a continual crowd of worshippers or spectators, consisting partly of strangers, but mainly of the native inhabitants, to whom the ceremonies of their own dear temple, their pride and their joy, furnished a perpetual, delightful entertainment. At times the temple limits were overpassed, and the sacred processions were carried through the streets of the town, attracting the gaze of all. Or, embarking on the waters of the Nile or of some canal derived from it, glided with a stately motion between the houses on either side, a fairer and brighter sight than ever. The calendar was crowded with festivals, and scarcely a week passed without the performance of some special ceremony, possessing its own peculiar attractions. Foreigners saw with amaze the constant round of religious or semi-religious ceremonies which seemed to know no end, and to occupy almost incessantly the main attention of the people. To attempt to check this immense tide of human feeling and habit, and turn it into one single channel, even though that channel were one of kindred idolatry, could have no other effect than to fill the land with disaffection. And the priests of the old forms would of course take an active part in making the discontent more prevalent. With such a condition of things in Egypt, it was inevitable that there should be in Palestine and the other subject countries of the Northeast, attempts to free themselves from the Egyptian yoke. Accordingly, we find letters from the Egyptian governors and native kings in those countries, reporting to the king of Egypt the dangers and invasions of their respective provinces and cities. Since the time of Thothmes III, the Hittites had been steadily growing in strength themselves as a nation, and had further added to their power by a confederacy of several neighboring peoples, and now they began to threaten the Syrian and Phoenician provinces of Egypt. A certain Azero, governor of northern Syria, whose father Dudu was grand vizier of the empire, and whose brother also held some office at the court of the king, wrote to his brother as follows, "O Kai, my brother, thus I speak, even I Azero, thy brother, unto thee may there be peace, and from the soldiers of the palace of the kind my lord may there be much peace. Had immediately I speak before the king my lord, publicly I speak, even I and my sons and my brothers, all being servants of the king my lord before him O I and Khatib have gone again with a present to Kazai who is among you. Verily the frontier, behold. I have reached from the orders of my lord I do not free myself, or from your orders, even I the servant of my lord. He king of the land of the Hittites in the country of Nukas is staying, and I am afraid of him and have defended myself. To Phoenicia he ascends. And if the city of Dunit falls, he stays in a place only 2 parasangs 7.36 miles from here, and I am afraid of him. Yet according to this order he remains until he quits it. And now one has gone with a costly present to him, even I and Khatib. To his father, Dudu, the same Azir wrote as follows, O Dudu, my lord, my father, thus speak I, Azir, thy servant. At the feet of my lord I prostrate myself. Behold, there has gone the prince of the king my lord unto me. From the commands of my lord, my God, my son God, and from the commands of Dudu, my lord, I do not free myself O my lord, Khatib remains with me. I and he will go together. O my lord, the king of the land of the Hittites has marched into the country of Nukas. but has not prevailed over the cities. May the king of the land of the Hittites quit them. Therefore now have we marched, even I and Kittub. A certain Ribadu, or Ribhadad, was governor of a province in northern Phoenicia, having the city of Gebel for his capital. Ebdazerda, which means he servant of Asherah, was the chief of the city of Barabardi, in the land of the Amorites, who had succeeded in gathering a considerable force of the Bedouin. And he and his four sons were invading Phoenicia and causing much distress to Ribadu, who was old and at the same time very sick. Accordingly he writes to the king of Egypt as follows. Ribadu says to the king of the world, the great king, the king of the universe, to whom the divine lady of Gebel has given strength. To the king my lord. At the feet of my lord, the sun god, 7 times 7 I prostrate myself. Early let the king my lord know that strong is the hostility of Ebdasherah against me. Now the city which contended against me he has taken. Again, what about Ebdasherah, the dog? And he has come against all the cities of the king, the sun god. Word to the king of the country of Mitanni Mesopotamia and the king of the country of the Cast Babylonia he has sent, and has taken the country of the king for himself. And now again he has collected all the Bedouin against the city of Sagada and the city of Ambi, and has taken also the territory of this city, and there is no place which the Bedouin have not entered. In another letter he writes thus, had is Ebdasherah, the servant, the dog. Yet he has taken the country of the king for himself. What is his origin? Yet he is strong among the Bedouin, strong in his power. And he has dispatched 50 convoys of horses and 200 foot soldiers, and they are stationed in the city of Sagada in his presence. Until the household troops appear he will not assemble all the Bedouin. Yet he has taken the city of Sagada and the city of Ambi. The word which Ebdasherah had sent to the kings of Mitanni and Babylon had caused them also to revolt, as is shown in the following letter. O the king, my lord, my son God, speaks Ribadu, thy servant, thus, at the feet of my lord, my son God, 7 times 7 I prostrate myself. The king my lord knows that Salmasala, the son of Ebdasherah, has entered the city of Ulaza, in order to strengthen the cities of Ardata, Yabilia, Ambi, and Sagata, all the cities, for themselves, and the king has sent a force to the city of Zamar until the king shall give counsel to his country in regard to the sons of Ebdasherah, the servant, the dog. The king of the country of the Cassi, and the king of the country of Mitanni are strong and have taken the country of the king for themselves already, and they have seized the cities of thy governor. Yet thou delayest in granting the request of thy commissioner, and they have seized the cities for themselves. Now they have taken the city of Ulaza. If, therefore, thou delayest until they have taken the city of Zamar and also have slain the commissioner and the household troops which are in Zamar, what could one do? And I could not march up to Zamar, the city. The cities of Ambi, Sagata, Ulaza, and Arvad, are hostile to me. They have plotted, even they, that they shall enter the city of Zamar, even these cities and their ships. And the sons of Ebdasherah are in the field. The sons of Ebdasherah were in the field to some purpose, too. For another letter shows their progress as follows. O the king my lord, my son God, I speak, even I, Ribadu, thy servant, at the feet of my lord, my son God, 7 times 7 do I prostrate myself. The king my lord has heard the words of the servant of his justice. I am very sick. Unto me has hostility approached. The sons of Ebdasherah descended into Phoenicia. They and all the country of the city of Tsumura and the city of Arkada armed themselves against the governor. And now in the city of Tsumura is their station. Behold, the governor is sick. On account of the attack he has left the city of Gubla, and there are not Zimrida and Yapa'adu along with me. Now accordingly has the governor sent to them, and they have sent 30 manes to him. Now has the king my lord heard the report of the servant of his justice, and has dispatched reinforcements in haste to the city of Tsumura to defend it and capture the soldiers of the palace of the king, the sun god. And the king, the sun god, has supplied me with the soldiers of the kingdom from the midst of his own country. A second time has the king my lord heard the report of his servant and has dispatched the garrison to the city of Tsumura and to the city of Urkata. Not only was the city of Zamar taken and the capital city Gebel threatened, but through the successes of Abdashura, Tyre also was infected with the spirit of revolt. Tyre seems to have been a very wealthy and prosperous city even then, for Ribadu wrote of it, "Behold the palace of the city of Tyre. There is no palace of any other governor like the palace of the city of Ugarita is it. Exceeding great is the wealth of the man, all of it." He thought that Tyre was entirely loyal and trustworthy, and even wrote, "Behold, the action of the city of Tyre I do not fear. The daughters of my brother I have sent to the city of Tyre from fear of Abdashura. But he is compelled at last to confess that even Tyre is excited against him. Here is the letter Ibhadad sends to his lord, the great king, the king of the world, to whom the divine lady of Gebel has given strength, to the king my lord. At the feet of the king my lord, my son God, 7 times 7 I prostrate myself. He king my lord knows that strong is the hostility of Abdashura, of the city of Barabardi, all my cities have gone over to him. The city of Gebel and the city of Tyre he has excited against me, and 2 messages he has sent, and he says to the citizens, am your lord. From the governor of the province of which Sidon was the head, the following report was sent. O the king my lord, my gods, my son God, my king, my lord. Speak thus, I Zimridi, the governor of the city of Sidon, at the feet of my lord, my gods, my king who is my lord, at the feet of my lord, my gods, my son God, my king, my lord, 7 times 7 prostrate myself. Verily the king my lord knows that the queen of the city of Sidon is the handmaid of the king my lord, who has given her into my hand. And that I have heard the words of the king my lord that he would send to his servant, and my heart rejoiced, and my head was exalted and my eyes were enlightened and my ears heard the words of the king my lord. And the king knows that I have sent in front the soldiers of the palace of the king my lord. I have sent everything as the king my lord commanded and the king my lord knows that hostility is very strong against me, all the fortresses which the king gave into my hand have committed the offense of revolt. In Palestine also the whole country was fairly ablaze with revolt and internecine strife. Each king was grasping all that he could for himself, while loudly professing perfect loyalty to the king of Egypt and charging all the others with rebellion against him. Jerusalem and the neighboring country seems to have been the center of disturbance, and Abd-Tab, servant or slave of Tab, the king of Jerusalem, the leading object of complaint. For instance, the city of Kala had been taken from its legal jurisdiction, and the governor in whose province it was, reported the matter thus, O the king my lord! My gods, my son God, by letter I speak, even I, Suardaka, thy servant, the dust of thy feet, at the feet of the king my lord, my gods, my son God, 7 times 7 do I prostrate myself. He king of the country have directed the mouth to make war. In the city of Kelkala he made war against thee the 3rd time. A cry for assistance to myself was brought. My city belonging to myself adhered to me. Abd-Tab sends to the men of Kelt. He sends 14 pieces of silver, and they marched against my rear. And the domains of the king my lord they overran. Kelt, my city, Abd-Tab removed from my jurisdiction. The pleasure park of the king my lord and the fortress of Bel-Nathan and the fortress of Hammer from before him and his justice they removed. Labapi the halting in speech occupied the fortress of Ninu and now Labapi together with Abd-Tab and his men has occupied the fortress of Ninu. Labapi, or rather Labai, as he himself wrote it, was addressed by the king of Egypt in regard to this report, and he answered for himself as follows. O the king my lord and my son God speak thus, I Labai thy servant and the dust of thy feet, at the feet of my lord and my son God 7 times 7 prostrate myself. Have heard the words which the king has sent to me, and here am I, and the king apportions his country unto me. I say, I am a righteous servant of the king, and I have not sinned, and I have not offended, and I do not withhold my tribute. And I do not refuse the request to turn back my lyres and wait. Now the food of my stomach they have taken away, and yet I do not complain, O King, my Lord, why second defense is that of entering the city of Gezer? But I say expressly they had taken, O King, my property and the property of Maltrel. How can I know the doings of Maltrel in regard to this or myself? The king has sent to Bin Sumia, he does not know that Bin Sumia along with the Bedouin had marched, and has given a city and property in it to my father, saying this, that if the king sends for my wife, I shall withhold her, but if to myself the king sends, I must pay a bar of copper in a large bull and conclude a treaty, since they have not performed the message of the king. Maltrel answered for himself thus, O the king my lord, my gods, my sun god, speak thus, I, Maltrel, thy servant, the dust of thy feet, at the feet of the king my lord, my gods, my sun god, 7 times 7 prostrate myself. He king my lord knows that strong is hostility against me and against Suyardatta. And the king my lord has taken his country from the hand of the Bedouin. If the king my lord does not dispatch chariots to capture the enemy they will slay his servants. In a series of 6 letters Abd Tob vigorously defended himself against the reports of these others. And also gave quite a full account of the actual condition of affairs in the country. These letters are here inserted in their order, for the view that they give of Palestine 150 years before the Exodus of Israel, as well as for their part in the history of this period. Number 1. O the King my Lord, speak thus, I, Abd Tob, thy servant, at the feet of my Lord the King, 7 times 7 prostrate myself had have I done against the King my Lord? They have slandered myself, laying wait for me in the presence of the King, the Lord, saying, Abd Tob has revolted from the king, his Lord. Behold, neither my father nor my mother have exalted me in this place. The prophecy of the mighty king has caused me to enter the house of my father. Why should I have committed a sin against the king, the Lord? With the king my Lord is life. I say to the commissioner of the king my Lord, why dost thou love the confederates, and the governors thou hatest? And constantly I am sending to the presence of the king my lord to say that the countries of the king my lord are being destroyed. Constantly I am sending to the king my lord, and let the king my lord consider, since the king my lord has established the guard who have taken the fortress Zay the king send help to his country. May he send troops to his country which protects the fortresses of the king, the lord, all of them, since Elimelech is destroying all the country of the king, and may the king, the lord, send help to his country say, I have gone down along with the king my lord, and I have not seen the tears of the king my lord. But hostility is strong against me, yet I have not taken anything whatever from the king my lord. And may the king incline towards my face. May he dispatch the guard to me, and may he appoint a commissioner, and I shall not see the tears of the king my lord, since the king my lord shall live when the commissioner has departed say, the countries of the king my lord are being destroyed. And yet thou dost not listen to me. All the governors are destroyed. No governor remains to the king the lord. May the king turn his face to the men, and may he send auxiliaries, even the troops of the king my lord. No countries remain unto the king, and the confederates have wasted all the countries of the king. If auxiliaries come this year, the countries of the king the lord will be preserved. But if no auxiliaries come, the countries of the king my lord are destroyed. O the secretary of the king my lord, Abd Tob speaks, a report of my words thou layest before the king my lord, there are destroyed by the enemy the countries of the king my lord. Number 2. O the king my lord, my son god, speak thus, I, Abd Tob, thy servant, at the feet of the king my lord 7 times 7 prostrate myself. Behold, the king my lord has established his name at the rising of the sun and the setting of the sun. Slanders they have uttered against me. Behold, I am not a governor, a vassal, to the king my lord. Behold, I am the ally of the king, and I have paid the tribute of the king, even I. Neither my father nor my mother, but the oracle of the mighty king, established me in the house of my father. Here have come to me 13 women as a present, and 10 slaves Suda, the commissioner of the king, has come to me, 21 women slaves and 20 male prisoners have been given into the hands of Suda as a gift for the king, my lord, as the king has ordained for his country. The country of the king is being destroyed, all of it. Hostilities are carried on against me as far as the mountains of Seir and the city of Gath Carmel. There is peace to all the other governors, but war against myself is raised, since I see the men and I do not see the tears of the king, my lord, because war has been raised against me. While there is a ship in the midst of the sea, this is the oracle of the mighty king. He conquests shall continue of the country of Nagrima and the country of Babylonia, and he now the fortresses of the king the confederates are capturing. Not a single governor remains among them to the king, my lord. All are destroyed. Behold, Tarbazu, thy soldier, in the great gate of the city of Zilu has fallen. Behold, Ziridi of Lashish, the servants who belong to the king have slain. Yaptakadu thy soldier, on the pavement of the city of Zilu they have murdered. May the king my lord send help to his country. May the king turn his face to the men. May he dispatch troops to his country. Behold, if no troops come this year, utterly destroyed will be all the countries of the king my lord. They do not tell to the face of the king my lord that the country of the king my lord is destroyed, and all the governors are destroyed, if no troops come this year. May the king send a commissioner, and let him come to me, even to me, with allies, and we will die with the king, our lord. O the secretary of the king my lord, say, I, Ebd-Tob, thy servant, at thy feet prostrate myself. Let a report of my words be laid before the king my lord. The servant of thy justice am I. Number 3. O the king my lord, speak thus, I, Ebd-Tob, thy servant, at the feet of my lord 7 times 7 prostrate myself. Behold, Malchil does not separate himself from the sons of Labai and the sons of Arzai to demand the country of the king for themselves. As for the governor who does this deed, why does not the king question him? Behold, Malchil and Tagi are they who have done this, since they have taken the city of Rubut. Here is no royal guard. May the king live eternally. May Pura go down to him. He has departed in front of me. He is in the city of Gaza. And let the kind send unto him the guard to defend the country. All the country of the king is revolted. Direct Eichbilkamu to come, and let him consider the country of the king my lord. O the secretary of the king my lord, speak thus, I, Ebd-Tob, thy servant, fall at thy feet. Let a report of my words be laid before the king. Abundance of life be unto thee, thy servant am I. Number 4. O the king my lord, speak thus, I, Ebd-Tob, thy servant, at the feet of the king my lord 7 times 7 prostrate myself. He king knows the deed which they have done, even Malchil and Suardam, against the country of the king my lord, marshalling the forces of the city of Gezer, the forces of the city of Gath, and the forces of the city of Kala. They have occupied the country of the city of Rabbah. The country of the king has gone over to the confederates. And now at this moment the city of the mountain of Jerusalem, the city of the temple of the god Uruz, whose name there is Alam, Genesis 14-18. Hebrews 7-2, the city of the king, is separated from the locality of the men of the city of Kala. A. The king listened to Ebd-Tob, thy servant, and may he dispatch troops, and may he restore the country of the king to the king. But if no troops arrive, the country of the king is gone over to the men, even the confederates. This deed is the deed of Suardam and Malchil. And may the king send help to his country. Number 5. And he now as to the city of Jerusalem, if this country remains to the king, why is it that the city of Gaza is fixed on for the government of the king? Behold, the country of the city of Gath Carmel, to Tagi and the men of the city of Gath has fallen away. He is in Bitsani, and we have affected that Labai and his country should give to the men of the district of the confederates. Malchil has sent to Tagi and takes his sons hostages. He has granted all their requests to the men of Kala, and we have delivered the city of Jerusalem. The guard whom thou hast left in it, Kapi, the son of Meiria, has assembled. Adalim has remained in his house in the city of Gaza. Number 6. A. The king consider all the countries which excite hostilities against me, and may the king send help to his country. Behold, the country of the city of Gezer, the country of the city of Ashkelon, and the city of Lachish, have given as their peace offerings food and oil and whatsoever the fortress desires. And may the king send help to his troops. May he dispatch troops against the men who have committed sin against the king my lord. If there come his year troops, then there will remain both provinces and governors to the king my lord. But if no troops arrive, there will remain no provinces or governors to the king my lord. Behold, this country of the city of Jerusalem neither my father nor my mother has given to me, it was an oracle of the mighty king that gave it to me, even to me. Behold, it is Maltrel, and it is the sons of Labai who have given the country of the king to the confederates. Behold, the king my lord is just toward me. As to the Babylonians, let the king ask the commissioners how very strong is the temple. And they have committed a very grievous sin. Thou hast delivered the provinces into the hands of the city of Ashkelon. Let the king demand of them abundance of food, abundance of oil, abundance of wine, until Poro, the commissioner of the king, comes up to the country of the city of Jerusalem to deliver Adai along with the guard and the allies. Let the king consider, let him speak to me. Let Adai deliver me. Thou wilt not desert it, even this city, sending to me the guard and sending the commissioner of the king. Thy grace is to send them. The roads of the king I have made in the plain and in the mountains. Let the king my lord consider the city of Ajalon. I am not able to direct a road to the king my lord according to thy instructions. Behold, the king has established his name in the country of Jerusalem forever, and he cannot forsake the districts of the city of Jerusalem. O the secretary of the king my lord speak thus, I, Ebed-Tob, thy servant, fall at thy feet. Thy servant am I a report of my words thou hast laid before the king my lord. The vassal of the king am I abundance of life be to thee. This lobby I seems to have had the ambition to take the whole of Palestine. For from Beridi, the governor of Megiddo, there was sent the following report of his threatening that city also, O the king my lord and my son God, speak thus, I, Beridi, the servant of the jurisdiction of the king, at the feet of the king my lord and my son God 7 times 7 prostrate myself. Let it be known to the king my lord that since the entrance of the soldiers of the palace, Labai has carried on hostilities against me, and we have not gone up against the cattle. And we have not gone up out of the exit of the great gate which I have opened, through fear of Labai, since he learned that the city of Avedi had received the soldiers of the palace. And now he has set his face to take the city of Megiddo but let the king strengthen and rescue his city in order that Labai may not take it. If he causes the city revolt from its allegiance, it falls this year. But verily let the king give 2 men of the guard to protect his city lest Labai capture it. If there come not first the 2 men, at the time when Labai marches up, the city of Megiddo he will smite. The king of Egypt, in response to these many and urgent calls from so many places at once, began by sending an army under the command of his general Horemheb, into Syria to meet the powerful combination which Ebed-Asherah had been able to effect there. The expedition was successful, and Ribadu was enabled to make the following joyful report, O the great king, the king of the world, the king of Egypt, I present myself, O creator of everything which is great, I the servant of the mighty Lord, to the king my Lord. At the feet of my Lord, the Sun God, 7 times 7 I prostrate myself. Verily is the king my Lord. Lo! Exceedingly powerful is he constituted. Lo! A mouth of judgment in thy presence exists. He men of the city of Tsumura belonging to the king, are subjects of the king. Lo! The city of Zarek sends this report, the 4 sons of Abdezerda have been captured, and there is no one who has brought the news to the king, as well as council. Behold! The servant of thy justice am I, and as for thee, what I have heard I have dispatched to my lord. A march has been made against the city of Tsumura which, like a bird whose nest on a precipice is laid, is exceedingly strong. And as for the messengers whom from the house, I sent, into the city of Tsumura I have seen their entrance. He was also enabled to report that they have taken Ebdashura, and that they had destroyed Ebdashura out of the country of the Amorites. This, however, was the extent of the efforts of Egypt, for Amenophis IV died shortly afterward, leaving no son, but seven daughters whose seven husbands and some of the great officers of the court and of the army entered upon a confused strife for the possession of the supreme power. Everything shows us a time of trouble, of continual revolution, and of civil discord. At last the power was obtained by Horemheb, who was married to a sister-in-law of the late king, and he was recognized in the lists as king. But the difficulties and disturbances lasted during the whole of his official reign, which is supposed to have continued about 20 years, 1620 to 1600 BC. Ramesses I was the man who brought order out of this Egyptian chaos, made himself king, and established a new dynasty. In the time of Egypt's weakness and troubles, the Hittites had made themselves the strongest people in the northeast. Their power had become so formidable that Egypt itself was in danger of invasion. The first serious business of King Ramesses, therefore, was to meet this danger. He accordingly marched with his army into Syria, and beyond, for he says that he was the first of the pharaohs who sought out the Hittites in the valley of the Orontes. He met the Hittites in a great battle. The king of the Hittites, though defeated, gave such evidence of his power that Ramesses considered it better to enter into treaty with him than to try to carry his arms any farther. A treaty of peace and alliance was therefore made between the two kings and their countries O eternity. His reign continued about 6 years, 1600 to 1594 BC. Seti I, Zur named Manetho, was the son of Ramesses I, and as one of the greatest and most warlike of the sovereigns of Egypt. The Bedouin tribes the Shasu had grown so bold as to make incursions into proper Egyptian territory. They had attacked even Heliopolis, and really controlled a portion of the country about the Tanitic mouth of the Nile. Seti marched with an army to drive them out. They were expelled with great slaughter, and were followed with terrible vengeance into the country of Edom. He then overran Dumia, took various fortresses, and ruthlessly slaughtered their garrisons, raging, as he himself tells us, like a fierce lion, and wading through a sea of carnage. He Shasu were turned into a heap of corpses in their hill country, they lay there in their blood. The entire region between Egypt proper and Canaan was subjected, the names of the strongholds were changed, and Egyptian troops were placed to them. The people of Syria the Kuru had supported the Bedouin against Egypt, which in turn now brought the armies of Egypt against them. And Edi boasts that he annihilated the kings of the land of the Syrians. This brought him to the border of the country of the Hittites. The Hittites were now more powerful than ever before, and he good conditions of peace and fraternity to eternity which had been entered into with them by father, were disregarded by Seti, or else the Hittite king had already disregarded them. For the inevitable war followed the approach of Seti to the Hittite border. He war at this point was long and desperate Lenormand. And though he well ordered hosts of the beardless, light red Kita, on foot, on horseback, and in chariots, gave battle to the invaders in the open field, and offered a gallant and stout resistance to the hosts of the Egyptians, yet here once more Seti was successful, and defeated the enemy with great slaughter, driving their squadrons before him in headlong flight, and killing a vast number of the leaders. A sculpture shows us he miserable inhabitants of the land of the Kita receiving from Seti this reed overthrow. A song of praise was composed for the occasion, which is appended to the sculpture, and runs as follows, Pharaoh is a jackal which rushes leaping through the Hittite land. He is a grim lion which frequents the most hidden paths of all regions. He's a powerful bull with a pair of sharpened horns. He has struck down the Asiatics. He has thrown to the ground the Kita. He has slain their princes Edi at length carried by assault the chief fortress of the country of the Kitas, Kadesh, the key to the whole valley of the Orontes. After this success, a treaty of peace and alliance was made between Seti and Mutner, king of the Hittites, by which the latter nation preserved their possessions entire. Even Kadesh was restored to them. but they engaged never again to attack the Egyptian provinces or foment rebellion against the authority of Pharaoh. And to leave him at liberty to attack and reduce to subjection the revolted nations who had obeyed his predecessors, and whom he had always regarded as subjects. During this quarter, Seti turned back to attack the Rotenu, who no longer acknowledged Egyptian supremacy, and had discontinued paying their tribute. Those between Lebanon and the Euphrates, that is, the Arameans, were easily subdued. The Rotenu beyond the Euphrates gave more trouble to the Egyptian conqueror. But some great battles brought about the complete submission of Mesopotamia, Assyria, and Chaldea. Seti admitted to an interview the chiefs of Nineveh, Babylon, and Singer. A last campaign in the mountains of Armenia re-established the supremacy of Pharaoh in that country. The whole of the conquests of Ptolemy III were recovered, and the Asiatic Empire of Egypt was completely reconstructed. He also conquered the Libyans at the northwest of Egypt, and restored the connection with Punt which Queen Hatshepsut had established. Seti was also one of Egypt's greatest builders. He grand olive columns in the Temple of Karnak, the chief glory of that magnificent edifice, which is supported by 164 massive stone pillars, and covers a larger area than the Cathedral of Cologne, was designed in its entirety, and for the most part constructed, by him. And even if it had stood alone, would have sufficed to place him in the first rank of builders. It is a masterpiece of the highest class, so vast as to excite his astonishment and admiration, so beautifully proportioned as to satisfy the requirements of the most refined taste, so entirely in harmony with its surroundings as to please even the most ignorant. Egyptian architectural power culminated in this wonderful edifice, its supreme effort, its crown and pride, its greatest and grandest achievement. And it only remained for later ages to reproduce feeble copies of the marvelous work of Seti, or to escape comparison by accomplishing works of an entirely different description. The Olive Columns, at Karnak, is not only the most sublime and beautiful of all the edifices there grouped together in such sort as to form one vast unrivaled temple, but it is the highest effort of Egyptian architectural genius, and is among the 8 or 10 most splendid of all known architectural constructions. This, however, was but one of the many great temples that he caused to be built at different places. One day as he king was engaged about the countries situated on the side of the mountains, his heart wished to see the mines whence the gold is brought. When the king went up there with those acquainted with the watercourses, he made a halt on the road to meditate quietly in his heart. As he meditated, doubtless being thirsty, it occurred to him that this was a long road without water. It is a place where travelers succumb to the parchings of their throats. Where is the place that they can quench their thirst? The country is distant, the region is vast. The man overtaken by thirst cries out, and of perdition. He there and then determined to find water at that place if it were possible. He proposed that as men were obliged to traverse that thirsty region to find the gold for him and his kingdom, he would do something for their benefit. He said, "Hey, come to acquit towards me their obligations, I will make for them the action of allowing them to live. They will offer a worship to my name in the course of years, they will come, and their generations to come will be as charmed as I am, on account of my power. For I am regarding the welfare of those around me." When the king had said these words in his heart, he elevated himself in the country. He was pleased to assemble the workmen, working the stone to establish there a cistern on the mountains in the desire of sustaining the fainting, in supplying him fresh water in the time of heat in summer. It was not merely a cistern in the accepted sense of the word as a receptacle for the storage of surface water that he proposed to make. He determined to find fresh water in the time of heat in summer. It was not merely a cistern boring an artesian well. His highest expectations were met. For he water came there in great abundance like the Abim of Kurdi of Abu. His Majesty said, "He God has heard my prayers, the water has come to me out of the mountains by the gods. The total which wanted water is made excellent during my reign, it does good to the pasturages of the shepherds." He then established their town and an august sanctuary in the midst of it, a town containing a temple. Then His Majesty ordered that orders should be given to the superintendent of the royal masons who were with him, and the sacred sculptors. It was made in an excavation in the mountain, a temple. The god Ra was placed in his sanctuary, Ta and Osiris in the great hall Horus, Isis and Ra-Mam and Seti himself as parhedral gods in this temple. The gods are delighted in its shrine. He has constructed a well before it. Never was made the like by any king except the king, performer of meritorious actions, son of the sun, Seti, beloved of Ta, the good leader, giving life to his soldiers, father and mother of all persons. He has produced water out of the hills, it goes along to men, and assistance to all trading in the lands. He also built a canal from the Nile to the Red Sea at the Gulf of Suez, over nearly the same course as that of the Suez Canal of the present day. His death ended a reign of about 30 years from about 1594 to 1564 BC. Ramesses II was the son and successor of Seti I. He was about 18 or 20 years of age at the death of his father, and reigned from that time for a period of 67 years, to about 1497 BC. At the death of his father, Ethiopia revolted, and the first task of Ramesses was to re-establish the power of Egypt in the southern countries. It required a long, bloody, and furious war to reduce things to their former order and subdue the rebels. But it was fully accomplished. This drawing of the forces of Egypt far to the south for 3 or 4 years presented an opportunity of which the restless Hittites could not forbear availing themselves. The king of Hittites spent the greater part of these years in perfecting a confederation more formidable than any that had ever been made against the Egyptian empire. From the Aegean Sea and the Dardanelles to the Euphrates, the nations the Dardanians, Mysians, Lycians, Pisidians, and apparently all the others were now allied under the Hittite king for at least one more stroke for independence. Ramesses did not hesitate to meet the issue thus raised. In his fifth year he led his army to the Orontes to seek the confederated forces. Near Kadesh a fierce battle was fought, in which the Egyptians were so successful that the king of the Hittites sued for peace. Ramesses was so glad of it that peace was granted seemingly without any special conditions. And without even leaving any garrisons in the country, he returned in great pomp to Egypt. 2 years after this Mutner, king of the Hittites, died and was succeeded by his brother Khedesira, and the war was recommenced with more fury than ever. It lasted 14 years with no truce or interruption. Under the young and energetic king, Khedesira, the success of the Hittite confederation was such that Palestine as far south as Ascalon was gained from the power of Egypt. At last the tide of war turned once more in favor of the Egyptian arms, and they drove the allied armies out of Palestine, Phoenicia, and Coel Syria, took Kadesh by assault, descended the valley of the Orontes to its extremity, and thus penetrated into the heart of the Kita country, pushing on even farther in the direction of Cilicia and Pisidia Ames's. During this long war, several times personally took command of his army in Asia. One of the historical tablets of the Ramesseum at Thebes shows him, after a great battle against the Kitas and their allies, receiving from his generals an account of the number of the enemy slain, whose amputated hands are piled at his feet. In another he is engaged in the fight. Two of his sons are pursuing the routed enemy, who fly towards a city under whose ramparts are already two other sons of the king preparing to make an assault. At last, in the 21st year of the king reign and 14th of the war, a real and final treaty of peace was concluded between the two belligerents, with conditions as favorable to the Hittites as to Pharaoh. The material passages of this treaty, undoubtedly the oldest diplomatic document extant, read as follows: He 21st year, the 21st day of Tybi, in the reign of King Ra-Usur-Ma, approved by the sun, son of the sun, Ramesh-Umariaman, endowed with life eternal and forever. On this day behold His Majesty was in the city of the house of Ramesh-Umariaman, making propitiations to his father Amun-Ra. Here came a royal herald, two royal heralds came, bringing a tablet of silver which the Grand Duke of Kedah, Ktazira, had sent of the King Ra-Usur-Ma, approved of the sun, son of the sun, Ramesh-Umariaman, endowed with life forever and ever, like his father, the sun, continually. Api of the plate of silver which the Grand Duke of Akita, Tazira, sent to the king by hand of this herald Tardisbu, and his herald Rames, to beg for peace of his majesty. He covenant made by the Grand Duke of Akita, Tazira, the puissant. Son of Marasara, the Grand Duke of Akita, the puissant. Grandson of Sapalala, the Grand Duke of Akita, the puissant. Upon the plate of silver, with Rayu's Rama, approved of the sun, the great ruler of Egypt, the puissant. Son of Ramanma Seti I, the great ruler of Egypt, the puissant. Grandson of Raman Pahu Ramses I, the great ruler of Egypt, the puissant, the good conditions of peace and fraternity to eternity, which were aforetime from eternity. This was an arrangement of the great ruler of Egypt with the great prince of Kedah, by way of covenant, that God might cause no hostility to arise between them as it happened in the time of Mu'adh-Nara, the Grand Duke of Kedah, my brother, that he fought with the great ruler of Egypt. But thus it shall be henceforth, even from this day behold, Tazira the Grand Duke of Kedah covenants to adhere to the arrangement made by the sun, concerning the land of Egypt with the land of Kedah, to cause no hostility to arise between them forever. Behold, this it is Tazira the Grand Duke of Kedah covenants with Rayu's Rama, approved by the sun, the great ruler of Egypt, from this day forth, that good peace and good brotherhood shall be between us forever. He shall fraternize with me, he shall be at peace with me. And I will fraternize with him, I will be at peace with him forever. T happened in the time of Mu'adh-Nara the Grand Duke of Kedah, my brother, after his decease Tazira sat as Grand Duke of Kedah on the throne of his father. Behold, I am at one in heart with Ramashu Mariaman, the great ruler of Egypt of peace of brotherhood. It shall be better than the peace and the brotherhood which was before this. Behold, I the Grand Duke of Kedah with Ramashu Mariaman the great ruler of Egypt, am in good peace, in good brotherhood. The children of the Grand Duke of Kedah shall be in good brotherhood and peace with the children of Ramashu Mariaman the great ruler of Egypt. As our treaty of brotherhood, and our arrangements made for the land of Egypt with the land of Kedah, so to them also shall be peace and brotherhood forever. There shall no hostility arise between them forever. He Grand Duke of Kedah shall not invade the land of Egypt forever, to carry away anything from it. Nor shall Ramashu Mariaman the great ruler of Egypt invade the land of Kedah forever to carry away anything from it. He treaty of alliance which was even from the time of Sapalala the Grand Duke of Kedah, as well as the treaty alliance which was in the time of Mu'adh-Nara the Grand Duke of Kedah my father, if I fulfill it, behold Ramashu Mariaman the great ruler of Egypt shall fulfill it, in each case, even from this day, we will fulfill it, executing the design of the alliance. If any enemy shall come to the lands of Ramashu Mariaman the great ruler of Egypt, and he shall send to the Grand Duke of Kedah saying, come and give me help against him, then shall the Grand Duke of Kedah come to smite the enemy. But if it be that the Grand Duke shall not come himself, he shall send his infantry and his cavalry to smite his enemy. When any from the lands of Ramashu Mariaman the great ruler of Egypt shall come to the land of Kedah to do service to any one, they shall not be added to the land of Kedah, they shall be given to Ramashu Mariaman the great ruler of Egypt. Or if there shall pass over any coming from the land of Kedah, and they shall come to the land of Egypt to do service of any sort, then shall not Rayu's Rama, approved of the sun, the great ruler of Egypt, claim them. He shall cause them to be given to the Grand Duke of Kedah. If there shall pass over one man of the land of Egypt, or two, or three, and they shall go to the land of Kedah, then shall the Grand Duke of Kedah cause them to be given up again to Rayu's Rama, approved of the sun, the great ruler of Egypt. But whosoever shall be given up to Ramashu Mariaman, the great ruler of Egypt, let not his crime be set up against him. Let not himself, his wives, his children, be smitten to death. Moreover, let him not suffer in his eyes, in his mouth, in his feet. Moreover, let not any crime be set up against him. If there shall pass over a man from the land of Kedah, be it one only, be it two, be it three, and they come to Rayu's Rama, approved of the sun, the great ruler of Egypt, let Ramashu Mariaman, the great ruler of Egypt, seize them and cause them to be given up to the Grand Duke of Kedah. But whosoever shall be delivered up, let not his crime be set up against him. Let not himself, his wives, his children be smitten to death. Moreover, let him not suffer in his eyes, in his mouth, in his feet. Moreover, let not any crime be set up against him. These words which are in the tablet of silver of the land of Kedah, and of the land of Egypt, whosoever shall not observe them, the thousand gods of the land of Kedah, in concert with the thousand gods of the land of Egypt, shall be against his house, his family, his servants. But whosoever shall observe these words which are in the tablet of silver, be he of Kedah, or be he of Egypt, the thousand gods of the land of Kedah, in concert with the thousand gods of the land of Egypt, shall give health, shall give life, to his family, together with himself, together with his servants' head, which is upon the tablet of silver. Upon its front side is the likeness of the figure of Sutekh the great ruler of heaven, the director of the treaty made by Ktazira the great ruler of Kedah. This treaty, proposed by the Hittite ruler, was accepted by Ramesses. In addition to this, Ramesses took a wife from the daughters of King Kedasira, gave her an Egyptian name meaning Ift of the great son of justice, and established at Zoan the worship of the Hittite god Sutekh in Ni of the most magnificent temples of Egypt. Thus the long struggle of the Hittites for independence was triumphant. And at last that nation occupies in the world a place of recognized equality with that of the proud and mighty Egypt. The powerful Hittites having made peace with the king of Egypt, it was not for the other and much weaker nations to think on any longer denying his sovereignty. The people of Mesopotamia and the East, therefore, asked him to submit to the king of Egypt before he invaded their country. One of the tablets of the Ramesseum represents Ramesses giving investiture to the chiefs of the Rotenu, that is, of the Arameans, Assyrians, and Chaldeans who recognized his suzerainty. The Asiatic conquests of Thames and Seti were thus recovered without the king being obliged to cross the Euphrates. Mesopotamia again paid tribute, and Egyptian residents were sent to the courts of all the native princes to exercise supervision over them. From this time to the end of the reign of Ramesses, that is, for nearly half a century, peace was preserved in Western Asia, once the scene of such long and sanguinary wars. Ramesses II transported peoples in large numbers from one part of the empire to another. Whole tribes of Negroes were taken from Nubia to Asia, and people of Asia were taken to southern Egypt and the Upper Nile. Hosts of captives had been brought into Egypt by Seti and others, and Ramesses II added greatly to their number. In fact, it is estimated that the slaves and subject peoples composed nearly a third of the population of Egypt in the time of this king. He made use of them, however, in building cities, constructing grand temples, and in other great works. For among the pharaohs he is the builder par excellence. It is almost impossible to find in Egypt a ruin, or an ancient mound, without reading his name. He seems to have conducted everything on an extravagant scale. He took more wives than any pharaoh before him. Even beyond all this, he went so far as to take one of his own daughters for a wife, and seems to have been the first pharaoh to do this. He had 170 children, of whom 59 were sons. Among the stranger peoples in Egypt at this time were the children of Israel. They were increasing so rapidly that they fairly warmed, indeed the land was filled with them. And as the time of the promise drew nigh which God had sworn to Abraham, they were constantly talking of the soon coming time when they would leave Egypt. In this Ramesses too saw danger. And as they had hitherto been a favored people in Egypt, dwelling in the best of the land, he decided to enslave them, and he said unto his people, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass, that, when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies, and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land." Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramesses or Ramesses, Exodus 13, 37. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, and in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service, wherein they made them serve, was with rigor. Exodus 1:9-14. As the more they afflicted them, the more they grew, Ramesses saw that his scheme was working the wrong way. He therefore took another turn. He commanded that all the male children should be murdered at their birth, at first by killing them outright, and, when that failed, by having them cast into the Nile. In which time Moses was born, and was exceeding fair, and nourished up in his father's house 3 months, and when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up, and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and deeds. And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren the children of Israel. Acts 7:20-23, and he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God, than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. Hebrews 11:24-26. And seeing one of them his brethren suffer wrong, he defended him, and avenged him that was oppressed, and smote the Egyptian, for he supposed that his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. And the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set them at one again, saying, Sirs, you are brethren. Why do you wrong one to another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge over us? Wilt thou kill me, as thou didst the Egyptian yesterday? Then fled Moses at this saying, and was a stranger in the land of Madian. Acts 7:24-29. And it came to pass in process of time, that the king of Egypt died at the age of nearly 100 years, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. Exodus 2:23-25. Hardly had Ramesses II, the Pharaoh of the oppression, died, when the empire he had founded passed away. Egypt was herself attacked by the enemy, and while rival princes were founding dynasties in different parts of the country, the cities were sacked and burned by savage marauders, and the people were compelled to bow the neck to kings of foreign race. Note on Ramesses II as the oppressor. The evidence that Ramesses II was the Pharaoh of the oppression of Israel is about as conclusive as any ancient event can be without being stated in so many words. It is now known from the Egyptian remains that he was the king who built or ainly rebuilt Pithom. El El Masguda is the name of some large mounds near Tel El Kebir and other places which were the scene of the late war. And M. Naville, who has excavated them for the Egyptian Exploration Fund, has found inscriptions in them which show only that they represent an ancient city whose religious name was Pithom, while its civil name was Sukwath, but also that the founder of the city was Ramesses II. In Greek times the city was called Hierapolis, or Aero, from the Egyptian word era, storehouse, reminding us that Pithom and Ramesses, which the Israelites built for the Pharaoh, were treasure cities. Exodus 1:11. M. Naville has even discovered the treasure chambers themselves. They are very strongly constructed, and divided by brick partitions from 8 to 10 feet thick, the bricks being sun-baked, and made some with and some without straw. In these strawless bricks we may see the work of the oppressed people when the order came, has said the Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. The treasure chambers occupy almost the whole area of the old city, the walls of which are about 650 feet square and 22 feet thick. Its name Pithom in Egyptian, Patum, signifies the city of the setting sun, and since it had another name, Sukwath, we can now understand how it was that the Israelites started on their march not from Goshen but from Sukwath. Exodus 13:20, that is, from the very place where they had been working. Says he, adjacent city of Ramesses was named from Ramesses II himself, and therefore must have been built by him. The other points in the present available evidence are so well presented in an article in the Century magazine of May, 1887, that we can do no better here than to give it in an extract from that article. In the month of July, 1881, at Deir al-Bahari, in Egypt, in a secret place deep in the side of a mountain, there were found nearly 40 mummies of kings, queens, princes, and priests. Among these were the mummies of Ramses II, Ramses III, King Pinatem, the high priest Nebseni, and Queen Nofretari. That it is the remains of Ramses II, oh doubt now exists, for in black ink written across the mummy case by the high priest and King Pinatem, is the record testifying to the identity of the royal contents. Then upon the outer winding sheet of the mummy, over the region of the breast, the indisputable testimony is repeated. June 1, 1886, these mummies were unwrapped and photographed. And pictures of the faces of the mummy dead were printed with the article in the Century, above referred to. The points upon the identity of Ramses II as the first oppressor of Israel are as follows. He ancient Egyptians have placed us greatly in their debt by a science that surpasses ours. Even in the extravagant fancies of childhood over the tales and heroes of the Bible, we never dreamed that someday we might stand face to face with the figure of that you king over Egypt who aid unto his people. Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Of that father whose daughter not only spared the weeping babe in the little ark among the flags, but adopted the child, and he became her son, and she named him Moses. Of that royal patron who thus educated him for the public service as a prince in his own household. And yet of that sovereign in whose breast the prejudice of race ran so deep that he sought to slay this Moses, his foster son, the moment he heard the hand of the latter had lifted itself against an Egyptian. It has often been remarked how the countenance of Ramses II, whether upon colossal monolith or mural carving, together with those of other members of the Ramesside line before and after him, can scarcely have been purely Egyptian. And the conjecture has as often been hazarded that the type of expression they wear is obviously Semitic. Such a surmise has had for its foundation not only the narrow retreating forehead and the aquiline nose, but the long head from chin to crown and the entire cast of visage. The strange traits are limited to the Theban race, or ruling class, in contradistinction to the race of primitive inhabitants of the lower Nile Valley. Among the ruins of Zoan, Mariette Bey found a memorial slab of Siant, carved with a vignette on the upper part and inscribed on the lower portion, which at once became famous under the title of He Tablet of 400 Years. The subject of the vignette is a scene representing Ramses the Great offering wine to the god Set in his human form, and wearing the white crown, an officer also in adoration standing behind the monarch. The object of the stele is thus revealed to be a recognition on the part of the king of that Typhonic Set or Sutekh, and a participation in his worship, who had been the national deity of the shepherds, at the ancient capital of these rulers. Why the date of 400 years from the king Set Apepenubti, he uses an era founded upon the reign of one of these shepherd kings, a predecessor of Apophis. Furthermore, the officer explains, His Majesty ordered that a great tablet of stone should be made in the great name of his fathers for the sake of setting up the name of the father of his fathers, apparently from his parent Seti back to Set Apepe, 4 centuries before, both named after the same deity. And thus we are given to understand that Ramses thereby sought to acknowledge and honor the line of the shepherd kings as his ancestors. Fortunately, we are today able to verify this acknowledgement and relationship in a conclusive, because physical way. And the same ruins of Zoan, Mariette Bey came across 4 very peculiar sphinxes, on the avenue leading up to the shrine of the temple. Writing to the Vicomte de Rouge, he describes them in the following terms. And beholding these strange figures, we perceive that we have under our eyes the products of an art not purely Egyptian, and also not exclusively foreign, and, accordingly, We conclude that the Sphinxes of Averroes may well excite the immense interest of dating from the time of the Hyksos shepherd kings themselves upon the right shoulder of each one of our four symbolical Sphinxes. Inscriptions, which had been graven there, have been chiseled out. But the name of the deity Sutekh still remains upon the head. According to the Salier Papyrus, Apophis reared a temple to the god Sutekh. And we cannot doubt that our sphinxes are owing to the piety of this king toward the deity of his nation, nor can we refrain from the thought that the sacred enclosure which these monuments were intended to embellish was the site of the temple of Sutekh at Averroes. We are now ready to make the verification. The tablet of 400 years and these sphinxes were discovered not far apart. Rameses the Great was the author of the tablet confessing descent from the shepherds, and today we possess the features of the latter copied by the son. The shepherds were the authors of the Zoan sphinxes, to which they imparted their own faces. Let us compare the two, the profile of the sphinx with the profile of the king. They are parallel, both have the same roundly retreating brow, the same arched nose, the same prominent lips, the same projecting chin, the same high cheekbones, the same hollow cheeks. What have they not alike? They are a startling match. The family resemblance is so complete that one might be tempted to suspect the Sphinx of really bearing the portrait of Ramses himself, rather than that of some shepherd king. But, unhappily for such a suspicion, Ramses too once, having found a similar Sphinx at the site of Pithom, or having removed one from Zoan, actually engaged in the discreditable work of appropriating it to himself by transforming the head of the shepherd into an image of his own. The alteration consisted mainly in removing the shaggy mane of the lion, in order to substitute the ram headdress with spreading wings, a reduction which leaves the head too small for the body, while the outlines of the countenance remain almost untouched in the stolen monument. Touch of verification is more than satisfactory. We are fully convinced that this tall king, so superhumanly towering as to be frightful to his enemies, rightfully belonged to the ruling, rather than to the native race of Egypt. And, strange though it be, we allow his claim of blood relation to those invaders, the Hyksos shepherds, whose expulsion from the delta required the entire strength of the 17th Theban dynasty expended in a war of 80 years. Here lies the secret of that uniform, peculiar, superior cast of physiognomy running through all the countenances of the Ramesside line, a line ever famous for being uncommonly handsome. When the 18th dynasty came to an end with King Harem-Hebi, the royal line was extinct on the male side. So the 19th dynasty was founded by a warrior, Ramesses I. But he was a usurper, lacking in an essential qualification. Royal blood is son, Seti I, was also a brilliant conqueror. But to the Theban priests and men of learning he, too, was unsatisfactory, because in like manner royal blood did not course in his veins, and because he bore the offensive name of Set. However, if, on the contrary, he was a scion of shepherd stock, then to us he is a curiosity, from the fact that the Hyksos features of Ramesses his son must have descended through him, and in so doing left on him the typical marks of this mysterious race. How is it? Has he, Seti I, got them too? Consult his portrait, and answer accordingly. Neither a long nor a second examination is required to perceive in his looks a survival of the Sphinx of Zoan on the one hand, and a prophecy of his offspring on the other. However, so varied are our resources that today we are not dependent on ancient art for an acquaintance with this refined and worshipful parent of him who forms the object of our inquisitive study. The famous Seti, too, was found among the royal mummies at Deir al-Bahari, along with Thothmes III, the illustrious, and Ramesses II, the conqueror. And when his winding sheets of mummy cloth were unwound, and when, for the first time in so many long centuries, the light revealed those idiosyncratic features which of old inspired many beautiful reliefs in stone, the merciless camera was also turned upon them, and in that sort of picture which is notorious for never flattering nor ever detracting, we have a proof of the very original himself, a proof of the Ramesside blood. In neither of these lines will anyone who makes the comparison require the help of hints as to points of conformity or affinity. Seti shrewdly made up for his own deficiency in the nobility then dominant, by marrying a princess of the last, or 18th dynasty, Tuwa by name, She was descended directly from Thothmes III and Amenophis III, whose granddaughter she was. And the monumental records acknowledge her as royal wife, royal mother, heiress, and sharer of the throne. Her mask, as it were, reveals another source whence Ramesses, her illustrious son, derived some of his Lassic type of countenance, along with the whole of his royal blood. However, was preeminently royal, not only in that her father was a king of the 18th dynasty, but in that on the maternal side, her mother, Ty by name, the queen of Amenophis III, was a princess in her own right. Here the author of the article fell into the mistake of thinking that Ty, or Ty, was the mother of the wife of Amenophis IV, and so into the further mistake of having this king to marry his own full sister. We now know that the wife of Amenophis IV was a sister of Ty, and so, as fully as Ty herself, was a princess in her own right. The tablets containing the letters of King Dusrata, the father of both of these ladies, were discovered in the very year 1887, in which this article was published in the century, but were not translated or published till the year following. However, this change back to the true personage of the mother of the wife of Seti I, does not in the least affect the point which the author of the century article makes as to the descent of Ramesses on his mother's side. For his object is to trace his parentage to Mesopotamia, and it is done as fully through Ty's sister as through Ty herself. Thus the wife of Seti I was the daughter of Amenophis IV, by Tatakhepa, the daughter of Dusrata, king of Mesopotamia. It will be remembered that Amenophis IV was also Huenaten, who was famous for having discarded the gods of Egypt totally, and under the influence of Ty, for becoming a fanatical worshipper of the sun-beamy disk. The articles continues, having thus traced the probable origin of Ramesses' ancestors on his father's side, by the aid of the tablet of 400 years, back to Chaldea, and the lineage of his mother, by the aid of the marriage record of Amenophis, back to Mesopotamia. He might be regarded in respect to race as an Assyrian rather than an Egyptian, might he not? Are we aware that a verse exists in the Bible, reading, "For thus said the Lord God, My people went down aforetime into Egypt to sojourn there, and the Assyrian oppressed them without cause," which always has been an enigma? Commentators, indeed, unanimously say the sojourn in Egypt is here contrasted with the captivity in Assyria. But this leaves the statement in the first clause abruptly suspended, and would characterize a carrying away into captivity incorrectly as an oppression, while in the very next verse, Isaiah 52:4-5, the discourse proceeds to turn from the Egyptian oppression to the contemporary captivity in usual and precise terms. "Now therefore, what have I here, said the Lord, that my people is taken away for naught?" In Babylon the people were treated as colonists and citizens, not as slaves, whereas the real oppression occurred in Egypt alone. It is impossible to resolve this enigma except by regarding the conception of the prophet as remaining in Egypt and referring to Egypt in both clauses of verse 4, the last bearing out and explaining the first. And then when the question is raised, how could the oppressor of Israel in Egypt be an Assyrian? The answer is ready. Our present investigation has already shown. Isaiah well understood in what way Ramesses the Great was an Assyrian in Egypt, and so did they whom he addressed, indeed this firstborn son of Seti and Tuatha, because inheriting the double royalty of his mother, was instantly hailed as king, and recognized by a fastidious aristocracy as the future sovereign of the land. And not only as a royal but as a divine being. To the people at large he was the personal representative of the divine nature. They adored him, offered prayers to him, sang hymns of praise to him. His ministers addressed him in reverent terms, his princes prostrated themselves in his presence, his wives really worshipped him. And he appears to have believed himself superior to men and even allied to the gods. For in such groups as that of Abu Kirshaib, or Pithom, he seated himself between two solar deities, Ra on the one side, Tum on the other, and made his own image larger than either of theirs. Indeed, he carried his vanity so far as to represent in certain sculptures Ramesses the king burning incense before Ramesses a deity. His very name signifies derived from Ra, nor does he hesitate to assume the titles on of Ra, on of the sun. Tiabu's symbol in Nubia, in the grotto or temple of Hathor on all sides, upon facade, walls, pillars, another figure is met with. Another presence keeps him company. Another regent reigns conjointly with him on the throne. This sacred abode is consecrated to Hathor, the Egyptian Venus, and the second personage who shares it with him is his beloved wife, the idol and ruler of his heart, Meren-Mut-Nefer-Uri. Closely compare the two countenances of king and queen and note a very apparent kinship lying back of, older than, the relationship of husband and wife. Upon a pillar deep within the recesses of this grotto, on the left, we may find a more exact delineation of this fair queen, revealing the same secret. Just the same hieroglyphs identify her as the oil wife, Great Lady Meren-Mut-Nefer-Uri. She dons the plumes and horns and disc of the goddess to whom her home is dedicated. She wears a coronet. And, not unlike some fashionable ladies nowadays, she bears upon her head the livery of a bird, that of a vulture in her case, however, a symbol of maternity. Above the beak of the bird rises a hooded asp, carrying a miniature disc of the sun, always the emblem of a sovereign. A large earring peeps from under a sunbonnet fringed with gold and falling around her shoulder. In her right hand she holds up a sistrum, or copper bow with crossbars strung with beads, ornamented by a head of Hathor, as a sign that she is a priestess of the highest rank or prophetess of peculiarly sacred character. While in her left she grasps a scourge as another sign of royal supremacy, variant of her dedication of the temple to him reads, according to Mr. Villiers Stewart, "O the sovereign of the two lands, lord of Upper and Lower Egypt, Usur-Mara, son of the sun, beloved of Ra, lord of crowns, Ramesses Meriamen, his loving lady, queen and princess, Nefer-Uri has built a temple in the locality of Abu by the waters. Grant him life forevermore." Rowing these epithets into a natural succession, is princess and queen at once, we may ask, does the first of these terms explain the romantic attachment, and offer the ground for the last? If so, the revelation is capable of a test which will either confirm or disprove it. Any step backward in her history would be a time when she had not yet assumed the title of Meren-Mut, beloved of the goddess Mut, just as her liege lord was proud to call himself Meriamen, beloved of Amen, and her son Meren-Ta, beloved of the deity Ta. And such a period is readily recovered. Among the bas-reliefs of West Silsilis this same queen may be observed occupied with the pious task of offering sacrifice to certain divinities. Here she is announced to the world as the oil wife, and the Rete royal lady, lady ruler of the two lands, etc., while her cartouche reads merely Eferuri. Her insignia are essentially the same, the plumes, etc., of Hathor, a coronet, but no aureus. And now she holds a sistrum in each hand high above the altars, upon which libation jars are standing. As a sistrum player, Ahiti, and in the act of performing certain religious ceremonies before an altar, she again signalizes her membership in that holy order of priesthood to which only the wives and daughters of kings could be. Another step backward in her history would be a time when she had not yet attained the position of queen or the title of oil wife, but was known simply as Rinses. Looking through the lists of royal daughters born to Ramesses, among the troop depicted at Ere we find one little girl portrayed beneath the king, accompanied by his lion and about to dispatch a group of prisoners, who lifts her arms on high and holds a sistrum in one hand, who wears a coronet, and bears the name of Eferuri. On the walls of the great temple here at Abu Simbel she also appears, beneath a similar scene, and is recorded as a Fertari by name. It is estimated that the daughter of Pharaoh the oppressor was not far from sweet 16 when she found the little waif upon the Nile. At this time she was only the princess Nefer-Uri, and the Bible is perfectly accurate in referring to her as Hare's daughter. As Rugsh believes, this occurred in the sixth year of Ramesses' reign, who may then have been 36 years of age. We know that he had grown-up sons, who were assisting him in war, when he himself began to rule. On the other hand, votive tablets in our Hathor temple, dating from the 38th year of Ramesses' reign, would indicate 48 and 68 as the ages of the royal couple when this sacred abode was finished and in constant use in 2 or 3 or 4 or more years after her discovery of the ark in the flags by the river Bring. The princess became the king peerless consort, and at first was distinguished by no other than her former name, the oil wife Nefereri. But presently, for some reason best known to herself, she added a second appellation, Mermud, the basis of the Thermothistae Mermud of Greek historians. Here lies the key of the strange procedure of Josephus, who first styles her Otter, then calls her Hermuthis, and finally describes her as co-regent in the administration of affairs, and this very singularly clears up the records of other historians hitherto obscure. One of them, Georgius Syncellus, calls Rameses Moses for a close approximation, yet not a perfect echo, Moses having lost an initial R in its transit across the sea and 2000s of years. Besides, he relates, he daughter of Pharaoh, Thermuthis, who was also called Pharia. This, too, has a familiar accent area, yet something is missing. What can it be? Again across the Great Sea and a space of 20 centuries Pharia has lost an initial N. If Georgius' record were to read a Pharia, nothing would be wanting. Thus according to this authority, the full name of Pharaoh's daughter was no less than Thermuthis Nefereri. Another of them, Sadrinus, tells us how the daughter of Pharaoh was named Aphitis, as well as Thermuthis, and Heres. Of course, as before, this Heres is a reduced survival of Nefereri, while Aphitis stand as a fragment of Mermut. And so in both combined we have represented about half of the long Egyptian designation Mermut Nefereri. Ratapanus, also, was right, as far as he went, in saying that Pharaoh's daughter bore the name of Eris, which selects the other half of Mermut. By putting the halves preserved by Sadrinus and Artapanus together, we get the whole of Mermut. After all, unconscious of all our perplexity in regard to her identity, the daughter of Pharaoh is silently waiting for recognition, in life size and bold relief, upon the walls of Hathor Grotto today. She wears all the grace and majesty of a real queen. A marked refinement betrays her superiority in rank and race to everything natively Egyptian. The narrative of Josephus respecting the events which took place after Moses had ceased to be an infant, abundantly exhibits Thermuthis as active and influential in the government as any queen could be then if his royal name had not been officially written by the high priest Pinatim upon his cerements. We would have been able readily to recognize and safely to identify the great Rameses from his iconographic monuments. Hebrew calendar. Nisan, or Abib. March-April. Tyre, or Ziph. April-May. Sivan. May-June. Tammuz. June-July. Ab. July-August. Elul. August-September. Tisri, or Ethanim. September-October. March-Ezvan, or Baal. October-November. Chislu. November-December. Tebet. December-January. Sabat. January-February. Adar. February-March. Vi Adar. The intercalary month.